madam, s'il vous plaît, I ask you, I beg you, eu peço que tenham os vossos lugares para darmos início ao nosso trabalho, porque a pontualidade também é um fator importante e temos que deixar que haja também tempo para outros painéis e outros debates. Antes do mais, gostaria de saudar a presença de todos e de todas, a começar pelo meu caro amigo e colega John Greenway, meu colega presidente da Comissão das Migrações da Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa. Gostaria de saudar também todos os oradores e a relatora que estão aqui comigo na mesa e que apresentarei nome a nome, portanto, quando for a sua intervenção. E gostaria só de dizer aqui algumas palavras introdutórias, antes do mais, sobre as regras deste painel, as regras e os tempos, porque é importante. Cada um dos oradores terá cerca de entre 10 a 15 minutos. Quanto mais tempo sobrar, mais tempo haverá para o debate. No final do debate, a relatora terá também 5 minutos para fazer uma exposição sumarizada daquilo que aqui foi discutido. E o debate será dividido o tempo entre metade da audiência e metade para as respostas dos oradores. Na audiência, gostaria que cada um dos intervenientes não excedesse os 2-3 minutos para dar mais tempo a mais pessoas colocarem questões. Como é muito óbvio que nestas conferências, às vezes há pessoas que não compreendem que os oradores estão aqui deste lado da mesa. E, portanto, o que eu espero, o que nós esperamos desse lado, são perguntas objetivas que se colocam aos oradores. E os oradores procurarão explicar. Não é para haver uma multiplicidade de outros oradores a fazer discursos intermináveis. Portanto, nós queremos que isto seja prático, útil e efetivo. E é nesse sentido que iremos conduzir os trabalhos. Falando agora sobre a questão do tráfico de seres humanos e da exploração e da violência, gostaria de dizer-vos que nós temos uma convenção, além dos instrumentos das Nações Unidas, mas estamos aqui na Europa e, portanto, gostaria de enfatizar este facto. Nós temos uma convenção contra a exploração, portanto, do tráfico de seres humanos e do Conselho da Europa e que é, de facto, o primeiro instrumento jurídico vinculativo na Europa. E é um instrumento que está muito focalizado numa abordagem dos direitos humanos em relação às vítimas do tráfico, em relação à prevenção e em relação também à repressão dos autores, portanto é um dos aspectos contidos nesta convenção. Será importante que se faça uma distinção entre o que é o tráfico de seres humanos e o que é a imigração ilegal e o que é a ajuda à imigração ilegal. De facto, o tráfico de seres humanos conduz as suas vítimas a fins de exploração laboral, a fins de exploração sexual e, por outro lado, a imigração ilegal e a ajuda à imigração ilegal levam a que muitas vezes os imigrantes ilegais se tornam eles próprios umas vítimas preferenciais dos tráficos de seres humanos. Portanto, nós estamos perante um fenómeno que significa, em termos crus, uma autêntica moderna escravatura dos tempos atuais. E, portanto, nós temos que, por um lado legal, por um lado político da vontade política, mas, sobretudo, também por um lado cívico da sociedade e por um lado instrumental da administração pública, nas suas vertentes múltiplas, seja vertentes dos serviços de fronteiras, dos serviços de imigração, dos serviços de saúde, sejam vertentes nos serviços de apoio social, em todo o lado é possível nós termos uma intervenção coletiva que tenha em mente proporcionar às vítimas do tráfico, proporcionar, digamos, um tratamento condizente com a sua condição de seres humanos e, por outro lado, sermos implacáveis na perseguição destes indivíduos, sejam masculinos ou femininos, que são absolutamente inaceitáveis os seus comportamentos. Já que estamos aqui numa conferência organizada pela Conselho da Europa, pela Assembleia Parlamentar, eu gostaria já agora de chamar aqui um pouco a brasa à minha sardinha, à nossa sardinha, para vos dar uma informação. É que no próximo dia 3 de dezembro de 2010, em Paris, a nossa Assembleia Parlamentar organizará uma grande conferência sobre a dimensão parlamentar da luta contra o tráfico de seres humanos. E, portanto, esperamos que seja também um momento alto e importante desta luta. Depois, dizer-vos que a nossa Assembleia Parlamentar, e aqui tem havido uma grande colaboração entre a Comissão da Igualdade de Oportunidades entre Mulheres e Homens e a Comissão, portanto, de Migrações, tem havido no sentido de focalizar nas mulheres migrantes muito da atenção daquilo que tem a ver com a violência, tem a ver com o tráfico. Eu costumo dizer, aliás, indo um pouco mais longe até do que aquilo que os papéis oficiais dizem, que a mulher migrante ilegal é triplamente penalizada. Ela é penalizada em termos de violência porque é imigrante, porque é mulher e porque está ilegal. E porque está ilegal, tem medo, tem vergonha e muitas vezes não denuncia a sua situação. Portanto, eu diria, resumindo, que nós encontramos nas mulheres migrantes seres humanos que têm grandes vulnerabilidades em função do sexo, em função da sua condição social, em função da sua dependência económica. E, portanto, é isso que nós hoje aqui gostaríamos de ouvir dos nossos oradores, esta análise dos fatores de risco que levam as pessoas a estarem vulneráveis, não apenas as mulheres, obviamente, as crianças em geral, portanto, os menores, os homens que também são vítimas de tráfico. Nós gostaríamos de ouvir ideias concretas. Gostaríamos de ouvir como é que é possível aperfeiçoar a cooperação, gostaríamos de ouvir como é que é possível harmonizar as diferentes instituições que têm um papel nesta matéria, como é que é possível estes instrumentos das Nações Unidas e do Conselho da Europa serem levados à prática para que, efetivamente, nós possamos colocar um fim a uma prática que é a todos os tipos de verberar e que é inaceitável nos tempos de hoje. Portanto, vou já terminar esta intervenção inicial de lançamento, digamos, do tema, para já dizer que a nossa relatora, Helena von Heldorf, é vice-presidente do Instituto para a Assistência Internacional e Solidariedade. Como vos digo, ela terá um papel que não é fácil, porque eu já o fiz muitas vezes também, que é tentar captar o essencial de tudo o que aqui for dito, para resumir e transmitir para as conclusões desta grande conferência. E, para já, vou dar a palavra, aqui à minha esquerda, à senhora Joy Ngozi Ezeilo, que é a relatora especial das Nações Unidas sobre tráfico de seres humanos. Portanto, tem a palavra, se faz favor.
Thank you, the chair, fellow panelists, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. This is the second day of this very important conference. And since yesterday we've been talking migration, and today, of course, we are bringing in an element that is intricately linked or intertwined with migration, that is trafficking. Whether you're looking at migrant smuggling, they share similarities but also distinct. And for my purpose, sometimes I also want, especially in state response, that they are also looked at distinctively. When we're looking at trafficking, I wouldn't bore you with the statistics. We know that trafficking is one of the fastest growing criminal activities that result in serious breaches of human rights. We know, of course, that the scale is very difficult to measure. So quality data is also very scarce here. And the fact that we mix it up with smuggling, other irregular migration, doesn't also help. I often say that trafficking is migration gone wrong. And if you're looking at the topic of what we are looking at in this panel, trafficking, violence, exploitation, the definition of trafficking as contained in the protocol to prevent, suppress, and punish trafficking in persons, otherwise called the Palermo Protocol, contains those elements of exploitation and violence are constituent elements of that definition. And that definition has become the standard bearer. Many countries have modeled, it's quite comprehensive. It may have problems, but broadly speaking, it's adequate. And even the European Convention on Action Against Trafficking in Human Beings also adopted that. And many other sub-regional frameworks are all founded on that. With regard to the issues of trafficking, especially combating trafficking and measures taken at sub-regional and regional organizations, such as is part of organizing this conference, we think that they have a role to provide, especially in terms of multilateral response that is, again, very close to realities of victims that will also help us in effectively combating trafficking. With regard to this issue, I would like to really look at four issues. What constitutes a human rights approach in trafficking, in combating trafficking? What is victim-centered approach or child-centered approach that we require, again, to combat trafficking? And the issues relating to persons of concern, such as internally displaced individuals or persons, asylum seekers, refugees, and the others in that category in addressing vulnerabilities to trafficking. When I mentioned the issue of the elements in definition of trafficking, violence talks to the issue of the means used, which could be by force or use of threat, coercion, abduction, deception, all of that define the violence, and violence often is accompanied in terms of issues on trafficking, and that marks the distinction between trafficking and also migration or migrant smuggling, which doesn't result in such violence. Of course, if it does, then it will transform. It becomes then trafficking. Again, the issue of exploitation. According to that definition, exploitation can be for exploitation of prostitution of others, or other sexual exploitation, exploitation by forced labor or services, slavery or practices similar to slavery, servitude, and then also removal of organs. And often this part also, in terms of statistics, we know is a growing phenomenon, but the statistics are even more hard to come by. Again, on the issue of a human rights-centered approach, when we talk about that, especially there is always the feeling that if we are talking about human rights, then we can't look at trafficking, especially from the perspective of migration. We know that trafficking is a complex phenomenon. We can look at it from crime control, border control perspective, criminal justice perspective, the human rights perspective of migration and labor. And all I'm saying is that we cannot look at it from migration or crime and border control perspective alone. For us to adopt a comprehensive and holistic approach, it must include the human rights perspective. And what does human rights perspective tells us is issue that in trafficking, we are dealing with human beings. It's a modern-day slavery that shames all of us. And because we are dealing with human beings, interventions must be people-centered, because trafficking results in cumulative breaches of human rights, which includes issue of right to dignity, right to freedom from slavery or forced labor, the issue of right to freedom of association, movement, freedom from violence itself, and the right to earn a decent livelihood. They are all rights that are compromised in the process of trafficking. And in having a human rights-centered approach, it is not contradictory or in conflict with a criminal response, criminal justice response. Rather, two of them can work together to provide a better perspective to the issue. And if you're looking at the human rights perspective, it advocates that human rights be placed at the center of any response to combat trafficking. That we should not criminalize the victims themselves who have been trafficked. That in our response shouldn't be conditional, that if victims fail to cooperate, then they will not get any assistance and protection. And then the issues that are important to emphasize here include the issue of identification, protection, and support to victims. In identification is where we have the greatest problem, because we often lump trafficking victims with cases of irregular migration or illegal migrants. At times, there is complacency or even deliberate attempt not to identify or misidentify. As a special rapporteur, when I go on country missions, and at times I request to visit detention facilities for illegal migrants, sometimes states are very reluctant to let me in, and if they do also, they refuse that I talk to the illegal migrants themselves. And at times I'm left in no doubt that most of them, or at least a significant proportion of them, are victims of trafficking. But the response of the state is that they already criminalized somebody, they are arrested, they are detained, and they are repatriated even without allowing for opportunity of identifying referrals or responding in a way that respects their human rights or restore their dignity that has been lost in the process of their being trafficked. And this is a growing problem, because we cannot reduce vulnerabilities to trafficking if we continue to handle this in this manner. The issue of restrictive migration policies have actually been counterproductive sometimes, especially if we don't have opportunities for safe migration, and also if we don't respond in a human rights perspective in a way that we can even reduce harm and avoid victims being re-trafficked. I have spoken and I've read and heard about a lot of narratives of victims, and I've met quite a number, as you can imagine, and I've received a lot of communication. One thing that struck me is the fact that victims of trafficking, sometimes when you speak with them, they say, oh, this time I was unfortunate, this is what happened to me, I think next time I'm wiser for this and I'm going to try again. So you see that the situation, the root causes, their vulnerabilities have not been addressed. And if they have not been addressed, then they are likely to be trafficked again. So in a way, you see them, you know, the issue of migration, the push and pull factors, and how also it relates to push and pull factors of trafficking. And this challenges us to develop a multi-sectorial, multidisciplinary approach, especially to have prevention. Prevention that deals with root causes of trafficking. And this root cause will include demand, whether demand for cheap labor, demand for sex tourism, gender discrimination, inequalities, poverty. Because poverty, if people are poor, they are likely to want to move from less favorable conditions to what they consider as favorable conditions. They are lured with opportunities of jobs, of earning a livelihood. Always the stories are intertwined with their poverty. And this is a major vulnerability that we have to address. We know that trafficking affects men and women, but we know that it affects more women and children. So it is gendered, and it is a form of gender-based violence. And we have to also look at it from that perspective and address those gender inequalities. Often when I make the connection, the nexus is there, and I go on a mission and I start taking on issues of violence, domestic violence, these are also factors that predispose the victims. And some states and stakeholders are like, what is the connection between this? I said, trafficking, of course, is a form of gender-based violence. We need to also know that in migration policies, the safe migration options reduces vulnerabilities. And again, we need to look at, there is no one-size-fits-all, especially when it has to deal with victims and you're looking at protection of victims. And that is why we talk about child-centered approach as well, or victim-centered approach. Because children, for example, when they are trafficked, need a separate, because of their age and physical and mental maturity and their specific vulnerability because of that age, we have to look think about the best interest of the child, and we have to make that paramount as advocated or entrenched in the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So we have to develop age and appropriate intervention. I go to some places, you find that there is no child-specific shelters. So when children, unaccompanied children are intercepted, they often put them also in facilities where they have adults, maybe for even meant for adult victims of violence, domestic violence. Also, this happens often that states don't have specific assistance or facilities, if shelters as shelters, even for women who are trafficked. And these are things that we need to think about, and these are things that we must focus on if we have to take a child-centered perspective. We know that trafficking, the issue of numbers, you know, some countries, we emphasize on prosecution. The trafficking protocol, of course, deals a lot with emphasis on prosecution, the number of cases prosecuted. But it's not just about these numbers. And some, again, the numbers are mixed with those in irregular situation. I think beyond the numbers, we need to think of a sustainable way that we can combat this phenomenon. In the light of even the phenomenon, I sent questionnaires around countries just to ask about their perceptions on the issue of trafficking, whether it's declining and whether they're affected as a country. We of course know that trafficking knows no border. And the countries came back, almost out of the 84 responses I got, all of them say trafficking is a growing problem, it's not declining. And we know that in terms of economic crisis, there is even the fear is real that it may be exacerbated. And again, that even there will be lesser fund and budgetary allocation towards combating trafficking. And that will even roll back on what some of the gains that we have made. I think in trying to make submissions, I think even though trafficking is often intertwined with other criminal activities such as smuggling, drugs and arms trafficking, states must avoid treating trafficking only from crime and border control perspective or simply as a migration problem. We need multiple approaches that will focus on various perspectives that I've mentioned, especially the human rights perspective. We can also have in fact, in the criminal justice response, it has to also have the perspective of human rights. Even the traffickers need right to fair trial. It's also a right that has to be recognized. We need to deal more with the root causes of trafficking, which we have not sufficiently dealt with. We need to also reconsider our policies, especially policies of restrictive migration policies of favored countries. For this, unless we begin to address this, we will insufficiently tackle trafficking. In addition, we need to pay attention to preventive measures. And the current prevention efforts are flawed. In fact, having a global view of this, I decided in my forthcoming report to the General Assembly to focus specifically on prevention and to be in a position to share good and best practices and what is not effective response. I think states must improve identification process. Identification is key to ensuring that we have a victim-centered approach and that victims are protected and assisted and their human rights respected. I often say that we must address the gaps which are put in form of three C's, and that is the issue of capacity, the issue of coordination, and issue of cooperation. So we have to build capacity of law enforcement agencies, judiciary, prosecutors, but beyond that we often forget the issue of labor inspectors. We need to include them, they are important. We need to also coordinate anti-trafficking measures, ensure that they don't adversely affect human rights, otherwise it becomes collateral damage. We need to look at that. And finally, cooperation is imperative at all levels because trafficking knows no border. No one country or even a government can solve it alone without partnership. And the partnership must include also civil society and must be child-centered and victim-centered approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Mazzello, for your effort to be restrict to our time. I think our debate will profit also. And thank you very much for your remarks and your opinions and your suggestions. Now I give the floor to Dr. Manuel Jarmela Paulos. He is the director of the National Service on Foreigners and Borders, dizendo em português, o diretor nacional do Serviço de Estrangeiros e Fronteiras. Tem a palavra, se quiser, aqui ou ali, portanto, onde se sentir mais confortável.
Obrigado, Sr. Presidente. Gostaria de saudar todos os presentes e dizer que é para o Serviço de Estrangeiros e Fronteiras uma honra co-organizar esta conferência com parceiros tão ilustres e cuja atividade tem sido indiscutivelmente pautada pelo respeito pelos direitos humanos de todos e, em particular, dos imigrantes. Tivemos a iniciativa de propor esta conferência e a sua realização em Lisboa porque, sendo nós um país de emigrantes e agora também de imigrantes, as questões que se relacionam com as migrações e respeito pelos imigrantes nos tocam muito particularmente e assim podemos todos participar e estar presentes neste evento. Na temática dos direitos humanos e das migrações, há fenómenos que os desprezam e violam e contra os quais devemos direcionar um combate sem tréguas, como é o caso do tráfico de seres humanos. De referir iniciativas, entre outras, como o Programa de Estocolmo, aprofundando o espaço de liberdade, justiça e segurança, e o Action Oriented Paper, dando relevo à dimensão externa da União Europeia, preconizando assim medidas e princípios eficazes e criando linhas diretrizes para dotar de eficácia este combate tão urgente. Temos a noção que o tráfico de seres humanos assumiu novas facetas, como seja a vertente do tráfico de seres humanos para a exploração laboral, que tem aumentado. No entanto, tal não significa que tenha diminuído o tráfico de seres humanos de grupos mais vulneráveis, como as mulheres e as crianças, nomeadamente para a exploração sexual. Recentemente, também a servidão doméstica adquire uma dimensão crescente e preocupante face aos contornos de gente diferenciada que a fomenta e a uma maior dificuldade da sua investigação, pois passa-se dentro de portas e muitas vezes dentro de áreas diplomaticamente protegidas. A proteção das crianças e a defesa dos seus direitos, como proclamados na Convenção das Nações Unidas sobre os Direitos da Criança, passa necessariamente por medidas que as protejam do tráfico de seres humanos. Foi, aliás, nesse sentido, a comunicação da Comissão de 2006 que definiu uma estratégia europeia para os direitos da criança, referindo que as crianças em situação particularmente vulneráveis devem ser alvo de atenção especial. A reflexão que nos foi proposta para esta conferência fez-me pensar, sobretudo, em questões mais do que em soluções. Com efeito, existem já inúmeros instrumentos internacionais e europeus contra o tráfico de seres humanos, bem construídos, prevendo alguns até mecanismos específicos de monitorização para além de decisões-quadro contra o tráfico de seres humanos e diretivas, entre outros. Poderíamos referir o protocolo adicional à Convenção das Nações Unidas contra o crime organizado transnacional para prevenir, reprimir e punir o tráfico de pessoas e, em particular, de mulheres e crianças, o designado Protocolo de Palermo de 2000 e o seu mecanismo de avaliação de implementação. Podia também referir a Convenção do Conselho da Europa relativa à luta contra o tráfico de seres humanos, que promove um reforço do quadro de prevenção, combate e proteção dos direitos das vítimas de tráfico e um mecanismo de monitorização na sua aplicação feita aos Estados pelo GRETA. A Declaração de Bruxelas, de setembro de 2002. A Diretiva do Conselho, de 2004, Diretiva 2004/81, relativa ao título de residência concedido aos nacionais de países terceiros ou de países terceiros que sejam vítimas de tráfico de seres humanos ou objeto de uma ação de auxílio à imigração ilegal e que cooperem com as autoridades competentes. As recomendações apresentadas no relatório de dezembro de 2004 do Grupo de Peritos sobre Tráfico de Seres Humanos, ou mesmo ter em conta a Declaração do Porto formulada no contexto da Conferência de Tráfico de Seres Humanos e Género realizada no Porto em 2007 durante a presidência portuguesa da União Europeia. Mas mesmo assim, e esses são apenas alguns dos muitos instrumentos que têm sido sedimentados num esforço sério para combater o tráfico de seres humanos e proteger as crianças destes fenómenos, há algo que falta para uma verdadeira eficácia e a reflexão que hoje nos reúne é aceita como necessária. Refira-se que até a mera recolha de dados sobre o fenómeno, pelas diferenças que conhecemos de conceitos, pela ilegalidade e clandestinidade do fenómeno, não tem conseguido resultados concretos. E sem uma noção precisa da realidade que se refere tão bem no número de pessoas traficadas e sob que formas, torna-se mais difícil tomar as medidas adequadas. Urge aplicar indicadores comuns, ainda que inicialmente minimalistas, tendo em conta as diferenças já supra-referidas que dificultam a recolha de dados. Sir Thomas Beecham, um conhecido maestro inglês e fundador da Orquestra Filarmónica de Londres, disse que há duas regras de ouro para uma orquestra: começar juntos e acabar juntos. O público, e permitam-me a expressão, porque não é minha, está-se nas tintas para o que acontece no meio. Parece que também na luta contra o tráfico de seres humanos e na proteção das crianças contra o fenómeno se conseguiu começar juntos. Em diversos fora, criaram-se instrumentos e formas de luta contra este fenómeno e aparentemente também se interrelacionaram os referidos meios de forma a acabar juntos, num quadro institucional em que todos deram o seu melhor e prosseguem os mesmos objetivos. Mas ao contrário da situação de Sir Thomas Beecham, e esta conferência revela-o, na proteção dos migrantes na luta contra o tráfico de seres humanos, o que acontece no meio interessa, existindo a consciência que é necessário ponderar formas inovadoras com o objetivo de zelar pela efetiva aplicação dos instrumentos e políticas europeias que lutam contra o tráfico de seres humanos. De que forma inovadora é que as políticas europeias de proteção dos imigrantes e, em especial, das crianças contra o tráfico de seres humanos devem ser prosseguidas para otimizar os objetivos já definidos, foi acreditando que um dos caminhos a fazer deve também ser a ponderação de formas inovadoras de proteger as crianças no combate ao tráfico de seres humanos, que o Serviço de Estrangeiros e Fronteiras de Portugal conduziu uma campanha de sensibilização contra o tráfico de seres humanos dirigida, entre outros, às crianças. Assim, gostaria de vos transmitir alguns dados sobre esta campanha, recordando que já a Declaração de Bruxelas sobre Prevenção e Combate ao Tráfico de Seres Humanos de 2002, entre outros instrumentos que lhe sucederam posteriormente, referia a necessidade de sensibilizar para a prevenção, prevendo que as campanhas de informação devem ser um processo contínuo e não estar confinadas a um espaço limitado. Também mais recentemente, a Declaração do Porto apelou ao Conselho, à Comissão e aos Estados-membros que, desenvolvam campanhas de sensibilização, quer nacionais, quer ao nível europeu, como por ocasião do dia 18 de outubro, Dia Antitráfico de Seres Humanos da União Europeia, identificando claramente os grupos mais vulneráveis e os métodos e atividades associados, de forma a abranger todas as etapas deste processo, promovendo e implementando estratégias na área da prevenção. Cientes que o tráfico de seres humanos constitui uma violação dos direitos humanos e uma ofensa à dignidade e integridade dos seres humanos e que apenas pode ser combatido com uma abordagem integrada, baseada no respeito dos direitos humanos e que tome em consideração a natureza global e transversal do fenómeno, levou a que, inicialmente, se celebrasse um acordo entre o Serviço de Imigração e Fronteiras de Portugal e Brasil, com vista ao lançamento desta mesma campanha de sensibilização nos dois países. Formação e sensibilização para este fenómeno são palavras de ordem e foi o entendimento que as forças e serviços de segurança dispõem de uma mais-valia em termos de conhecimento do fenómeno no terreno que pode contribuir para informar, sensibilizar e prevenir o tráfico de seres humanos. Também aos 3 P's do tráfico de seres humanos, prevenção, punição e proteção, tem que se acrescentar um quarto de parcerias, ou seja, a necessidade de estabelecer parcerias para prevenir, punir e proteger, quer entre serviços, entre países e com organizações internacionais. Esta campanha em parceria entre vários países foi designada Não Estás à Venda, por ter como um dos instrumentos de sensibilização o livro do Conselho da Europa com esse título, em forma de banda desenhada, retratando situações de tráfico de seres humanos para exploração sexual e de mão de obra. Por acordo com o Conselho da Europa, as autoridades portuguesas traduziram para a língua portuguesa o livro e já foram editados, até ao momento, mais de 35 mil exemplares em português. No decorrer da 6ª reunião do Diretor de Serviço de Migração e Fronteiras da Comunidade dos Países de Língua Portuguesa, realizada na cidade da Praia em 2008, foi expresso o compromisso dos restantes serviços de imigração e fronteiras da Cplp de aderirem à mesma campanha, realizada nos mesmos moldes e em simultâneo. Em particular, para os participantes estrangeiros nesta conferência, gostaria de realçar que a comunidade dos países de língua portuguesa reúne Angola, Brasil, Cabo Verde, Guiné-Bissau, Moçambique, Portugal, São Tomé e Príncipe e Timor-Leste, e que este grupo de Estados está situado em 4 continentes e engloba um total de 230 milhões de pessoas. A Cplp assume-se como um projeto político cujo fundamento é a língua portuguesa, vínculo histórico e património comum dos 8 que constituem um espaço geograficamente descontínuo, mas identificado pelo idioma comum. Relembro que tem um propósito comum: projetar e consolidar no plano externo os especiais laços de amizade entre os países de língua portuguesa, dando a essas nações maior capacidade para defender os seus valores e interesses, assente sobretudo na defesa da democracia, na promoção do desenvolvimento e na criação de um ambiente internacional mais equilibrado.
Tem 3 minutos.
Por esta razão, o envolvimento simultâneo dos vários serviços de imigração dos países da Cplp na realização desta campanha Não Estás à Venda reveste ainda um interesse acrescido pelo âmbito territorial que abarca e pelo facto de serem partilhados idênticos objetivos de sensibilização e de defesa, incluindo princípios de direitos humanos preconizados por organizações internacionais que sempre pautaram a sua ação pelos mesmos, como as Nações Unidas, o Conselho da Europa ou a Organização Internacional para as Migrações. Entenda-se esta campanha de sensibilização Não Estás à Venda como um passo da Cplp no sentido de caminhar na direção a um mundo de integração e não de exclusão, e onde a dignidade do ser humano deve ser sempre o ponto de partida e não a procura do resultado de um conjunto de ações repressivas cuja previsão é necessária, mas de todo não devia constituir regra. Consideramos que todas as formas de sensibilização são válidas e elas devem ser extensivas a todos os setores profissionais, com especial enfoque nos grupos profissionais que poderão confrontar-se com vítimas deste crime, bem como as pessoas mais vulneráveis, em particular as crianças, poderão ser alvo de aliciadores. A colaboração entre serviços congéneres dos nossos países na luta contra este crime, em que uma das principais características, indiscutivelmente, é a sua transnacionalidade, potenciará a eficácia deste combate em que os direitos humanos são fragilizados na sua totalidade. Assim, a campanha que inicialmente os Serviços Estrangeiros e Fronteiras promoveu em Portugal contra o tráfico de seres humanos, sob o nome Não Estás à Venda, com base no referido livro que já vos citei, teve uma dimensão transnacional e estende-se hoje a outros países da União Europeia. Seria fastidioso da minha parte estar-vos a dizer os vários passos que esta campanha teve, mas de facto a nossa grande preocupação foi levar esta campanha junto das escolas, junto de diferentes instituições, no sentido de sensibilizar não apenas as potenciais vítimas, mas sobretudo também, e obtendo uma particular atenção, em relação aos profissionais que trabalham com estas potenciais vítimas, no sentido de, numa atitude permanente, os alertarem para os perigos que existem nesta matéria do tráfico de seres humanos. No final da campanha são analisadas as respostas ao referido questionário. Nós, durante a campanha, produzimos, de facto, um questionário e um dos dados que vos posso dar é que, no caso concreto de Portugal, esta campanha abrangeu 13 mil crianças e um dos resultados surpreendentes é que, por exemplo, apenas 6% destas 13 mil crianças afirma saber o que era o tráfico de seres humanos. Isto é um dado objetivo que só foi possível pela dimensão da própria campanha e, sobretudo, tendo em conta o objetivo concreto que era da sensibilização, quer potenciais vítimas, quer potenciais, nomeadamente, os profissionais que trabalham com estas potenciais vítimas. Pretende-se também aferir não só a eficácia das atividades e técnicas utilizadas, como também as futuras ações a desenvolver que representem uma mais-valia para a proteção das crianças no combate ao tráfico de seres humanos. Sr. Presidente, para terminar, gostaria de referir que a globalização que caracteriza a realidade atual contribui para que os fenómenos como o tráfico de seres humanos e, em particular, de crianças, não tenham fronteiras. Só podemos ser combatidos e evitados se todos nós estivermos sensibilizados e informados sobre o mesmo. Tendo, no entanto, como ponto de partida que a inovação dos mecanismos sobre o tráfico de seres humanos não deve sobrepor-se a um esforço de inovação na concretização das políticas prosseguida contra o tráfico de seres humanos e que o desenvolvimento da sociedade civil deve ser fomentado de forma a uma maior aposta na prevenção do fenómeno. Por último, gostaria de referir mais uma vez que a globalização que caracteriza a realidade atual contribui para que os fenómenos como o tráfico de seres humanos e, em particular, das crianças, não tenham fronteiras, só podendo ser combatidos e evitados se todos nós estivermos sensibilizados e informados sobre o mesmo. Um combate eficaz a este crime é, por si só, uma defesa dos direitos humanos que estão em causa. E que, mesmo que o fenómeno seja mais sentido nos países que noutros, a violência contra os direitos humanos que este fenómeno concretiza não pode deixar ninguém indiferente. Muito obrigado.
Obrigado. Passamos agora para o terceiro interventor deste workshop, o Sr. Peter von Bethlen-Falvy, é diretor executivo do Centro de Ação Política Europeia e Internacional e, portanto, dou-lhe a palavra.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It is indeed very difficult to speak after an eloquent statement like presenter, like the Director General of the Ministry of Interior, with whom we are also in my former capacity, with whom we had a lot of good cooperation. I'm just calling on his words, innovation, globalization, and the respect for civil society. I think that we have a lot of points, and I would for that actually thank the Council of Europe, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe and the Ministry of Interior of Portugal to having us to speak for this about these opportunities on innovation and the new approaches. And therefore, I thought since we had a very thorough presentation by Joy Ngotiadzielo as well, I will just maybe pick up a few points and then to leave it to the chairman how to deal with this. And the chairman is looking on the watch, on the clock. I realized that the clock shows still 5 minutes to nine, and I was very happy that we started 5 minutes before nine, but now I know it's a deception. So the first point I would like to make is I fully agree with the Director General that we have to concentrate on particular groups, vulnerable groups, and as you may know, we have last month organized the first roundtable of the Friends of the Belgian EU Presidency precisely on this subject, and I'm very grateful to you to send your distinguished representative to this group, namely Luisa Gonzalez, who spoke about the about your Lusophone prevention project, and due to your intervention and your experience, this will be one of the items during the Belgian EU presidency, during the ministerial conference on the 18th and 19th of October 2010 in Brussels. We will have a particular group on the children, and this particular good example of, I would say, in the spirit of Vasco da Gama, will be brought up because we need it in Europe, in fact. And we had from the beginning on very little of good examples, although I have to tell you another historical fact that the Portuguese have, of course, as you know, played a very special role, very prominent role in defining European policies in this field, also by Antonio Vitorino, with whom we have started one of the first awareness campaigns in Budapest in 1999, and he already took much of his experience from Portugal in the round. And since then, the European Commission has funded a lot of projects with various results in this field. But now, to my first point, who are actually the groups, the target groups of the concern, and whom did we identify during our last meeting in Brussels as particularly vulnerable when it comes to the breaches of human rights? As you properly said, the minors generally, but out of the minors, who are the most vulnerable are the children, the minors forced to combatant activities. We very seldom mention these groups because we are very Europe-centered, and we are very much thinking that all the trafficking and all the bad and good things are happening in Europe, but there is a big world around us, and you have implicitly mentioned it, and we have to be aware of it, and the Director General has also mentioned it. We have to have a global approach, and we have to see the overall picture of trafficking. So those are the minors forced to combatant activities. Hundreds and thousands of minors are forced to combatant activities, to drugs, mentally and physically disabled people, even within Europe, and the member states of the Union are forced into the trafficking. Women, of course, for prostitution. Then you mentioned the violence, domestic violence. It's a main point. Then at places, any group, at places of large and massive UN and international concentration of UN personnel, EU personnel, military personnel, tourist places, we have it all. I don't want to mention populistically the World Football Championship, because last time we thought something will happen and it happened less. But nevertheless, those are the attractive places where the things the human rights breaches of this kind will happen. And what we defined actually more or less for the as a gap for the also for the Belgian and the upcoming presidencies was the link between the police, border guards, cooperation and the health sector. We have many of the, and we looked at the research, many of the victims, prostitutes, forced marriages. We have seen that people are ruined psychosocially. They are having all sorts of disorders. They are HIV positive and they have to be treated by our health system. So there are two points. The protection of the victim itself and the protection of our security. And we have done very little. We are now discussing with the Commission and the European Parliament to change and to innovatively enter this gap, as the Director General told us. We have to, of course, also see some other groups which will come up, but those are, I think, the main points. Now, the second point which I want to mention is the implementation of the new instruments. What happens, what are the possible innovations, or what are the expected innovations from the Lisbon Treaty, from the Stockholm Programme, from the action-oriented paper, and from the October Declaration, the Ministerial Conference, which we organized with the Swedish Presidency last October. The first thing, which is maybe and perhaps in my opinion innovative and where we could expect some new developments, is the creation of the anti-trafficking coordinator on the EU level. I also have to tell you, because we are here in this open house of discussion, that we have expected, of course, the concept of the European coordinator to be more in its scope and content larger than it is now described and promoted by the Commission. As you know, the job is now being the job description circulated to the EU member states, and we will see to what extent, and this is my wish, national parliaments, and this is probably already too late, but at least the European Parliament will have a say in the direction how this job, how this function should be developed. For the moment, it will be a position which will be attached to the Director General of the Interior Commissioner, Mrs. Malmström, and we will see, we will cooperate, of course, with this job, and we will see what will happen. But I would like to invite also this House and the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe to take a good look on such developments and to see to what extent your distinguished committee could cooperate with this new institution, to what extent this new coordinator will fulfill the expectations to create and to cooperate with the already existing THB rapporteurs. To my knowledge, we have a very good example, maybe more than one, but I would like to quote just one, in Netherlands, where we have a rapporteur on trafficking, a quite independent rapporteur, who is not, to my knowledge, reporting to a particular department in a government, but reporting to the parliament. Now, this new European anti-trafficking coordinator, we'll have to see what models do we have in Europe. As you may know, we are sometimes drowning in our structures, our own structures, and all the EU member states have established a coordinated mechanism, which is in many ways very different from each other. We have ministries of family, youth and social affairs coordinating such coordinating bodies within the governments. We have ministries of interior. We have other EU member states where the lead is being taken by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It doesn't matter. We have it, but those are non-binding committees, and this is rather sometimes a quite informal group, not even exchanging the actual datas, not exchanging the appropriate information. I don't misunderstand me, I'm not criticizing it, but sometimes the gap between the European developments and those coordination groups is quite large, I have to say, and there something must be happening. And if you ask me, and you don't ask me, but I tell you what I think, why this gap has developed in the past 15 years, it is because very often, if you look at our national parliaments, if you look at the initiatives in this field, there is very little initiative coming out, very little questioning. I'm not looking at the Portuguese parliament at all, where you are a host, but the majority of the EU member states, of the 27, even if you take the 28 and some other potential countries, this question is not anymore a priority, and I would wish that our elected parliamentarians take it up, and that the link to the European Parliament and our decision makers in Brussels be strengthened. So this is also something where the action-oriented paper, as the Director General of the Border Police and the Security of Portugal told us, there is space for it in the post-Lisbon, in the treaty area, to work closely on this subject. It is a lot of space for us to improve the so-called foreign dimension of the justice and interior. The Lisbon Treaty gives us a new opportunity. The action paper gives us a new opportunity. The partnership which you mentioned with third countries, what you practice already, it's an innovation, and I think that we have to learn from it, because in the partnership, fighting crime, as you said, it's a crime against humanity, you can decide on priorities, you can decide on the methods, they can even decide on the prevention possibilities, except there is one point which we did not address properly and where we will have to work for years, and this is to change our mindsetting, to change the mindsetting of our foreign policymakers, of our diplomats, of our foreign ministries, who are still regarding this problem as a side problem. I just tell you an example, even on the EU level, when we discussed many years ago the new neighborhood concept and the policy. Those who have architected this policy have never thought even of migration, have never thought of trafficking in human beings. The argument was always, well, this is not our cup of tea. Please go to the Justice and Home Affairs. This is absolutely inacceptable for us to speak about the internal security. No, I would say it's not internal security, it's a global problem and global relations. And now, let me finish, because I have a great number of points on the post-Lisbon treaty, what we should be doing and what not, but I would like to call one point where the Council of Europe has an immensely strong and important role, and this is the convention which was mentioned against trafficking in human beings, and in particular the construction of monitoring this, the implementation of this convention, namely the creation of GRETA. It is also, I think, the right question, what innovation do we have? What type of ideas do we have on the levels of the national parliaments, on the level of the European Parliament? Can one link the work of the European expert group on trafficking with GRETA on evaluation? What is needed today in Europe is an impartial way. It's an impartial way of monitoring. We don't need a box. We don't need many boxes, but we need innovative ideas. We need criteria. As the Director General said, we need an index. We need a regular reporting. As you may know, the Americans, the US government has introduced the TIP report, which is every year basically more or less putting names and shames on certain countries. Our member states, the European member states, have a lot of work with that, because they have to correct the report, they have to contribute the report. Now we have a new institution in the make, this anti-trafficking coordinator. Maybe we can make it work with GRETA together, with the European expert group which was created as a consequence of the Brussels Declaration, where Portugal played an immensely important role in 2002. Maybe because you mentioned the duplication and the avoidance of duplication, maybe one can do something. But innovation needs good example, innovation needs the goodwill, and I don't want to end on the negative note. We always mentioned, since 1992, coherence, horizontal structures, multidimensional structures, make one committee which would deal with this question on the level of the parliament, make a commissioner on the level of the European Union who would be dealing with such questions. Now, instead of having one commissioner for justice and home affairs, as you may know, we have two commissioners. And instead of having one concentrated hub in the European Commission, we have at least six commissioners dealing with the question. Now we have a humanitarian commission for humanitarian affairs, for social and labor affairs, the justice, the interior, the foreign relations, the enlargement, and the internal market. So I wonder who is going to coordinate this group of commissioners, but of course it's not my task, but one has to make sure that there is more consistency on the European Parliament level. The same prevails, that we have too many committees and of course too many new parliamentarians who still have to learn what is it about, what we are talking, and what do we want Quo Vadis for the future. So the last point which I make, and this is really the last point, is the creation of the European Public Prosecutor. Here too I would wish that the national parliaments, that the Council of Europe, the Assembly, plays a more active role in thinking. Thinking is not forbidden on the European level, not yet, but it may be. And I think that we need also on this level an innovation, how to link up. You have a mandate you have a mandate of the Council of Europe. This is your basic, intrinsic direction and mandate for human rights and human rights and justice, and you should see how this European public prosecutor institution will develop. Will it be purely a change of names from the Eurojust to a public prosecutor? Do we close a door before we open another door, or typically in European way, do we open all the doors and then we'll be even duplicating more and doing more? And my very last question is coherence, and this regards also the UN, and it's not just towards the governments and national parliaments in Europe, but also we need more coherence on the international level, where there is still very little coordination. Sorry to take your time, Mr. Chairman. I'm now really finishing. Thank you very much.
Não tenho que pedir desculpas, até porque a sua intervenção é extremamente desafiante. Também àqueles que são parlamentares e que estão nesta sala, sentem que deveria também ser uma conclusão destes trabalhos que os parlamentos nacionais têm que ser muito ligados à monitorização da aplicação desses instrumentos convencionais internacionais. E, portanto, penso que esse é um dos nossos objetivos, seja para a Convenção do Tráfico, seja para a Convenção dos Abusos das Crianças em termos sexuais, seja para muitas outras convenções. Os parlamentares estão muito próximos do povo, do público, e podem ter um papel importante para saber o que se passa na realidade e ver como é que estão a ser aplicados estes instrumentos. Ora bem, tenho que vos explicar que o Sr. Nick Clark, investigador sénior da London Metropolitan University, infelizmente não pode estar aqui connosco, mas teve a gentileza de nos enviar uma intervenção escrita que eu vou pedir aqui à nossa relatora, a Sra. Helena von Eldorf, para nos ler e assim também tirarmos proveito das suas reflexões e das suas propostas.
First of all, good morning everybody, and I would like to start by extending my thanks to the organizer, and especially I would like to thank to Luisa Gonzalez, who was the one who really insisted on shedding light on the phenomenon of trafficking and linking trafficking with the human rights problematic, and I really want to strengthen her contribution in this respect. So I have a double task. The one is to read out the presentation of our missing colleague who had to decline at the last minute. And then I will try to sum up everything which has been said and to pinpoint to the main conclusions or to the main problems and to the way forward, how should we continue this fight against trafficking. But let me just start by reading, this presentation, which has been sent to us. So these are the notes of Nick Clark, who is a senior research fellow at the London Metropolitan University. Deciding what constitutes exploitation is not simple in the context of work. Marx's approach was fairly straightforward. Capital requires workers to work for longer than they would need to simply in order to produce enough for their own needs. So all workers are exploited. Marx understood that in a bourgeois society, this is seen as fair. It is clear, however, that even in the capitalist system, there is a level of exploitation that is seen as being beyond fair, particularly if the worker is in some way oppressed, such as being subject to threats or actual violence, being held captive in some way, not being paid what was promised, or in some or other way misled about the nature of the work contract. In other words, the exploitation of a worker becomes unacceptable if the notion of free labor is fatally punctuated by the reality of the employment relationship. But as philosopher Gertrude Azorsky explains in her little book Freedom in the Workplace, the notion of free labor is not a simple one. Most workers, particularly those in the lower ranks of labor force hierarchy, find that their choices may be very limited by the economic reality of their lives, to the extent that they may have no real freedom when presented with harsh options such as taking lower wages or losing their job. Precisely what differentiates acceptable exploitation from the unacceptable, say on wages, will depend on a number of factors, such as regulation or legislation, such as minimum wage, or collective bargaining. In other cases, it may be a national threshold having some moral authority, such as the Council of Europe decency threshold or the London living wage, for example. In terms of whether labor is coerced or not, definitions vary, and the ILO definition of forced labor, work or service extracted from a person under threat of penalty, which includes penal sanctions and the loss of rights and privileges, where the person has not offered him or herself voluntarily, does not identify the detailed practices that an employer might deploy. As a result of finally having introduced legislation outlawing forced labor, which came into force in April 2010, the United Kingdom government gives us a useful list of behavior by an employer or their representatives that would be evidence of coercion. And that includes violence or threats of violence, threats against the worker's family, threats to expose the worker to the authorities because the worker's immigration status, for example, withholding the worker's documents such as a passport or identification, restriction of movement, debt bondage, or withholding of wages. They go further, so this list, which was established by the UK in 2010, and also list actions by an employer which could be indicative of forced labor. Giving workers, and this includes giving workers false information about the law and their employment rights, imposing excessive working hours, imposing hazardous working conditions, not providing safety equipment and clothing, and or charging for its provision, unwarranted and perhaps unexplained deduction from wages, intentionally not paying the full tax or national insurance, like Social Security, for the worker. Providing poor accommodation, like overcrowded, not licensed, or not having necessary gas or electricity safety certificates. Giving intentionally poor or misled information about the nature of the employment, such as the location or nature of the work. Isolating the worker from contact with others. Exchanging money with other employees, traffickers, etc. for the person's services in an arrangement which has not been agreed with the person concerned or which is not reflected in his remuneration. Most of these practices will be familiar to anyone with experience or representing or advising workers, as well, of course, to many workers themselves, particularly those in the more precarious sectors of the labour market, such as temporary agency workers, self-employed, construction workers, day labourers, home workers, freelancers, domestic workers, and those working for outsourcing contracts in cleaning and catering. Reports of similar and widespread abuse of temporary workers in British agriculture and fruit processing led to the establishment of the Gangmaster Licensing Authority in 2006. A survey of Polish and Lithuanian workers in Britain in August 2005 found that 1 in 4 had experienced some breach of their employment rights with non-payment of at least some hours worked. It is worth noting that not all these practices will be restricted to migrant workers, although there is frequently a correlation between industries and occupations with a high degree of precariousness, and those with a high proportion of non-native-born workers. And in line with Professor Ezowski's analysis of what constitutes freedom, not all of the practices will be demonstrably forced or on workers. Researchers looking at the use of agency workers in the British food and agricultural industry pointed out, quote, "Evidence also includes that migrants are more willing to work longer hours, without formal contracts, and in often unfavorable conditions to earn money in as short a period of time as possible. Some of the first work I undertook with migrants was with the Portuguese Workers Association in UK, beginning in 2001, and we found many examples of the practices listed above. Portugal is a long-established EU member, and citizens should therefore have full employment rights. But precariousness can be manufactured in a number of ways, because the worker is not legally entitled to work under migration or social security rules, or because he or she has entered into some sort of unlawful pact with the employment, for instance, not to pay tax by having earning cash in hand. Ignorance of the law and lack of language skills exacerbate this. And in the UK, we have the additional problem of a very weak enforcement regime in most cases. Even where there is enforceable rights, such as with the national minimum wage, for example, we find that those charged with enforcement may be reluctant to act if they suspect that the worker may not have the correct immigration statute, for example, or if they are domestic workers. I know that in the face of widespread abuses, particularly of workers, with uncertain immigration statute, it can be tempting to see the current international focus of combating trafficking as a potential source of help. This approach focuses not on getting restitution for employment rights abuses, but for immigration offences. So it will leave out those already present in a country but subjected to coercion and super-exploitation. And even for those who might be covered, who have been misled about the nature of the job to which they are coming, for example, the proposed cure may be worse than the problem. Defining trafficking is no easier than defining exploitation, as pointed out by John Salt in IMO 2000 publication on the subject. And those deemed to have been trafficked in a country may lose any legal right to remain. Unpaid wages will not be reclaimed, the employment terminated, and perhaps the worker will be sent back to the country of origin. Little wonder, then, that the Migrant Domestic Workers Organization, Justice for Domestic Workers, argues strongly that they want employment rights, not anti-trafficking legislation. They advise their members against accepting the label of victims of trafficking, choosing instead that of worker with workers' rights. This is despite the fact that these workers are amongst the most severely abused. For them, immigration-based legislation has little protection to offer. By contrast, the experience we have of the Gangmaster Licensing Authority approach is generally a positive one. The GLA function is to prevent abuse of workers, not to police the border. Employers of temporary labor who are found to have seriously abused their workers find themselves barred from operating in the GLA-regulated sectors of food and agriculture. Abusive employers are penalized, not their workforce. While the GLA has no formal powers to enforce restitution, some lesser offenders are offered an opportunity to clean up their acts, which can include paying outstanding wages. It is in part due to lobbying by the GLA, along with unions and NGOs, such as Anti-Slavery International, that forced labor has just become an offense. We have yet to see how well this will operate or what priority will be given to enforcing it under the new coalition government. But the fact that it focuses on what happens in the workplace rather than what happens in the border is a welcome development. Migrant workers, like all others, need strong employment rights, including the right to organize themselves, to reduce exploitation, and the resources devoted to the prevention of trafficking too little, if anything, to meet that need.
Obrigado. Iremos agradecer ao Sr. Nick Clark, de facto, a gentileza que teve e peço aos serviços que distribuam uma cópia desta intervenção, que também é bastante importante, para que a audiência possa ter, digamos, a versão integral daquilo que acabámos de ouvir. Temos cerca de 30 minutos para o debate. Vamos consagrar 15 minutos para que nos coloquem questões e depois 15 minutos para o restante, portanto, para os oradores poderem responder. Como disse, pediria que cada intervenção não ultrapassasse os 3 minutos para que possamos, pelo menos, ter 5 intervenções no mínimo. Peço que quem se levantar ou para quem usar da palavra para se identificar, para que todos possamos conhecer exatamente quem é que está a formular as questões. Portanto, não houve ainda um período prévio de inscrições, mas peço quem desejar a palavra. Para já temos aqui o nosso presidente, a Mr. John Greenway, para dar o pontapé de saída, por favor.
Well, I'm trying desperately to formulate my words into a question to honor your edict, Mr. Chairman, but maybe what I have to say will come across as a question. But I think that it's a shame that Nick Clark is not here, because I think what Yelena has just read out to us is a very profound statement as to certainly what has happened in the UK in terms of legislation. The trigger for the Gangmasters Licensing Authority was the death of the 32 Chinese people who were picking cockles off the seabed in Morecambe Bay when they were all drowned in the middle of the night. and people for the first time began to see the extent of enforced labour, and all of the things that were in that statement have come as a result of that. And I think he is right in saying that in many respects, if we are looking at the issue of exploitation, that focusing on employment abuses, not on the migration issue, is the correct one. Now, from the point of view of the Migration Committee, there are two observations I want to make. The first is that what is the root cause, as Joy Ngozi Ezelo mentioned this phrase, what are the root causes? You know, the root cause of exploitation amongst migrant workers is their irregular status. And this is, as you know from the conference we had in Paris, a joint conference between my committee and yours, Jose, the root cause with women is that they don't have any status at all. And whilst the presentations that we've had have not quite covered this point, in a way this might then be my question. Is this one of the conclusions that we actually ought to reach? Because we have concluded, we're about to do a report on this in the Migration Committee, we have concluded that women migrants need independent status. Because without it, you're never going to improve their situation. And I think the poor enforcement of employment law generally is something that our committee has commented on many, many times. But I think that you know, even with trafficking, you know, we tend to think about it more in terms of sex trade trafficking. But I think one of the speakers mentioned, I think it might have been Manuel, the growth in trafficking of domestic workers, including amongst children, behind the cloak of diplomatic immunity. You know, this in many respects is better addressed through employment legislation as it is through anything else. And I suppose my final comment is to reflect on what Peter said, this wonderful phrase that we are drowning in structures. And that's what we feel in the Council of Europe, I think, sometimes. If governments have the political will to implement all the conventions that we've actually already provided, you know, the Convention on Migrant Workers, not adopted, even the Convention on Trafficking, not universally adopted, you know, political will to deal with this is absolutely crucial. But somehow or other, out of this, and I don't give you a solution, we have to find a focus. The innovation that was mentioned earlier, we have to find a focus to create some new impetus in dealing with all of these subjects.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Greenway. Outra intervenção? Any other interventions?
Question.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. My name is Katerina Levchenko. I'm from Ukraine. I am a member of CDMG. And first of all, thank you very much for interesting presentation. And I'm addressing my question to Mrs. Joy Ngozi Ezelo. I'd like to support you that prevention is really a very important part of all activity against trafficking and human beings. And can you give some examples of the best practices in the area of prevention, trafficking, and human beings from the perspective of countries of destination to prevent so-called demand side? Thank you.
Muito obrigado. Outra intervenção? Por favor.
Gracias, presidente. Me da un poco de pudor preguntar, porque ayer los ponentes, los parlamentarios, hablamos mucho. A mí me gustaría escuchar la sociedad civil portuguesa que está aquí y que no he tenido la oportunidad de escuchar. pero como nadie pedía la palabra, por eso la pedí. Porque ayer planteaba la necesidad de reinterpretar la aplicación del subsistema jurídico internacional, el subsistema normativo, sin necesidad de que hubiese nuevas normas. A los juristas nos gusta siempre, como nos creemos el ombligo del universo, crear nuevas normas, así nos creemos más importantes. Pero es mucho más útil reinterpretar para aplicarlas de una manera eficaz. Entonces la pregunta es, como quiera que el mercado de la migración, el mercado del tráfico de seres humanos, es el tercero más lucrativo del mundo después de las armas y la droga, si hay oferta es porque hay demanda. Son nuestras sociedades, parte de nuestras sociedades, quienes lo están pidiendo. Entonces yo preguntaría a la mesa, ¿innovar dónde? ¿Innovar qué? ¿O al final solo una cuestión de recursos financieros y es una cuestión de voluntad política? Por eso yo lo que planteo es que, como durante 20 años asistiendo a estas cosas, los discursos en general son los mismos, siempre coincido con ellos y somos todos humanitarios y sensibles y solidarios, la pregunta es, ¿qué cosas tenemos que cambiar para que dentro de 20 años, cuando nos veamos aquí, la situación esté de otra manera y no estemos perdiendo la batalla como la estamos perdiendo? Porque es que la política, el Estado y el derecho está perdiendo la batalla frente al mercado, la está perdiendo en el ámbito financiero y también la está perdiendo en este asunto. Entonces yo lo que pregunto a la mesa, le pregunto a la sociedad civil portuguesa que está aquí, que me gustaría escuchar su criterio, y a la mesa, ¿qué cosas hay que cambiar para ver si este partido, ahora va a empezar el campeonato de fútbol, empezamos un poquito a empatarlo, porque por ahora nos van ganando por goleada? Gracias, presidente.
Obrigado. Mais intervenções. Há aqui um desafio à sociedade civil portuguesa. Pode ser civil, pode ser militar também. Por favor. Ah, por favor. Aqui na segunda fila, por favor.
Bom dia. Sou Mário Neves, do Serviço Estrangeiros e Fronteiras. E gostaria de fazer uma pergunta relativa ao artigo 29 da Convenção do Conselho da Europa relativamente ao tráfico de seres humanos, ao combate. Eu vou falar em inglês para não correr o risco de ser mal interpretado. Peço desculpa. I'm going to speak in English. So what I see here is a misunderstanding of different actors in the process of combating of traffic of human beings. I think different groups, which I represent one, a group and a service that is working hard in the investigation of these crimes, I don't see the other partners doing his job. What I mean is, last year I take a little girl of 17 years old in the net of these kind of crimes. I do my job as my group. We need to start and finish together, as my director said. This is very important. When we are going to see measures about this Article 29, what can we do more? Because we need to start together and finish together. Otherwise, we don't combat effectively these crimes. Thank you.
Na fila atrás, exatamente.
Eu chamo Rui Pedro, sou da Scalabrini Network e agradeço de facto o convite que foi feito à nossa organização, trabalho em Itália, e quero dizer duas coisas. De facto, as leis e os Estados não resolvem todo o problema do tráfico humano, porque até sendo eu um homem da Igreja Católica, muito antes de haver leis que punam o crime de tráfico humano, nós tínhamos já organizações que procuravam abrigar, sobretudo mulheres exploradas sexualmente. Aquilo que estamos a fazer, porque este debate pretende revelar boas práticas, senão vamos daqui insatisfeitos com carências jurídicas, dificuldades de aplicação da lei. O que estamos a fazer nós é, conseguimos reunir 20 redes nacionais numa rede internacional, porque da nossa experiência, ou se trabalha em rede, a nível das ONGs, ou então não há respostas capazes para proteger esta e aquela pessoa que foi identificada ou por um telefone anónimo, ou então que foi identificado por uma organização, ou pelo CEF, neste caso, que depois confia essa pessoa a uma organização religiosa. Portanto, é preciso trabalhar em rede. E nós estamos a procurar fazer isso, constituímos uma rede há 2 anos para coordenar e identificar as vítimas e ter normas comuns. Outra boa prática que estamos a fazer é a formação de pessoas que possam dar respostas adequadas, de facto, ao problema do tráfico humano. Neste momento, com a ajuda da missão OIM de Roma, estamos a efetuar cursos para religiosos e religiosas para que possam saber lidar sem prejudicar as vítimas e sem deixar os criminosos à solta, possam dar respostas capazes de salvar e de libertar estas vítimas. O terceiro ponto que queria dizer é, de facto, que as leis não resolvem tudo. Nós próprios temos grande dificuldade, muitas vezes, por exemplo, para obter uma autorização de residência para uma pessoa que foi identificada como traficada. Portanto, é preciso ter uma atitude humanizante e humanista, que em Portugal existe, para que possamos dar respostas rápidas a tal pessoa para que se possa efetuar um processo de aumento da sua autoestima, dela sentir-se segura de denunciar os seus traficantes e dela poder também ter um processo de reintegração. Aquilo que existe, de facto, a meu ver, a fazer é de, pedindo ajuda às ONGs e dando meios às ONGs, que estes planos nacionais e que estes planos legislativos que existem, que contemplem sempre o contributo fundamental das ONGs. Mais do que a polícia e mais do que os Estados, são as ONGs que às vezes identificam as vítimas de tráfico. E depois termino dizendo, lançando um apelo à mesa, porque de facto o nosso trabalho é fácil identificar o tráfico quando ele é de mulheres e de crianças. A sociedade civil entende, ela tem compaixão, mas é preciso cada vez mais estudar o fenómeno do tráfico de trabalhadores que Portugal, ao longo desta década que agora termina, viveu uma experiência grande de tráfico de trabalhadores e que não se conseguiu identificar devidamente, em que não se conseguiu criminalizar devidamente. Portanto, é preciso, na opinião pública, levar a conhecimento e criar mecanismos para que o tráfico de trabalhadores seja igualmente punido e detectado e criminalizado como o já é o tráfico de mulheres e de crianças.
Muito obrigado. Mais uma intervenção? Peço desculpa. Faz favor.
Eu chamo-me Feliz Galarrilhó, sou da Associação Ninho, que é uma instituição que trabalha com mulheres vítimas de prostituição e tráfico. O que aqui foi dito, é visível que há já muitos instrumentos para apoiar. Depois, na prática, esses instrumentos falham na sua aplicação. O que foi dito pelo nosso interventor anterior é que é uma realidade. Há instrumentos que visam o apoio a mulheres vítimas de tráfico, quando na prática tentamos ajudar, nomeadamente no encontro de documentação, porque estas mulheres são vítimas de tráfico, como aqui foi dito pela nossa relatora da mesa, elas são retirados toda a documentação, as mulheres são retiradas toda a documentação, depois é muito difícil conseguirmos documentar numa primeira fase estas mulheres. Eu trabalho em meio profissional e, portanto, o que me encontro, o que se me depara, são mulheres muito assustadas, que normalmente olham, e falo essencialmente de mulheres da África e também de mulheres mulheres do leste europeu, são mulheres que não estão familiarizadas com a língua, que têm receio face às pessoas do exterior que vão ao meio, que perguntam quem são estas pessoas que aqui estão, quem é esta pessoa, põem dúvidas se não serão polícia, se não serão advogados menos escrupulosos que querem alguma coisa delas, não têm documentos. A nível da minha instituição, o grande problema que se põe é como documentar estas mulheres para as poder ajudar. Nós temos, de facto, possibilidade de apoiar a nível humano, a nível da formação, a nível da inserção social, temos meios para o fazer. Põe-se-nos a questão como fazer este apoio a uma mulher que está completamente indocumentada. Esses documentos foram retirados pelas redes, é sabido, isto é um dado que toda a gente sabe. Põe esta questão, como cada pessoa, cada caso é um caso, como já foi aqui dito nesta Assembleia, como é que tratar individualmente cada caso. Percebi-me ao longo destes dias e da minha conhecimento anterior, há muita coisa feita, há muito boa vontade, foi dito aqui hoje que há instrumentos e há, a questão é como aplicar estes instrumentos depois na prática, lá na base, lá bem por terra. Foi aqui hoje dito também que as histórias do tráfico estão sempre ligadas às histórias de pobreza. Isto é uma realidade. E ligando isto ao que foi dito ontem nesta sala, pergunto-me o que é que se está a fazer para articular com os países de origem, para estancar a hemorragia na origem e não fazer pequenas injeções de transfusões de sangue, digamos assim, para ir às causas da hemorragia para poder estancar. Estamos numa sociedade global, eu penso que temos que ver esta questão do tráfico ao nível global. Claro que nós somos uma parte importante, nós somos, digamos que, aqueles que estão a sentir as consequências, mas as causas estão, se calhar, noutros lados e é às causas que temos que ir, penso eu. Eu não sou política, sou do campo social. No campo social é isto que me infere dizer.
Muito obrigado. Só temos tempo para mais uma última questão. Faz favor, última questão.
Muito obrigada, Sr. Presidente. Eu chamo-me Maria de Fátima Grilo, sou responsável pelo posto de fronteira 201 Porto de Lisboa, subdiretora central de fronteiras do Serviço de Estrangeiros e Fronteiras. A minha intervenção é apenas no sentido de referir que participei num grupo ad hoc coordenado pela Comissão Europeia que teve como objetivo estabelecer linhas orientadoras a inserir no Código Schengen de Fronteiras relativamente a melhores práticas e a procedimentos, alguns vinculativos, outros não vinculativos, devido à complexidade da discussão que foi encetada, sobre a vigilância na fronteira marítima e, portanto, uma resposta mais eficaz ao problema da imigração ilegal por via marítima. O que eu gostava de referir é que se verifica que existem várias organizações internacionais concordantes na abordagem a este problema, não só a nível comunitário, mas a Organização Marítima Internacional, a Organização Internacional do Trabalho, a OIT, entre outras, e que a discussão foi particularmente rica pelas conclusões que se atingiram. Desde logo, a dificuldade entre os próprios Estados-membros em ultrapassar um problema que é real, que é nós termos uma resposta a duas velocidades para o problema do ponto de vista operacional, que está a funcionar bastante bem, sob iniciativas várias, nomeadamente a Frontex, e a resposta a nível técnico, ou seja, do ponto de vista legal, em que eu concordo plenamente com o que disse o senhor, que agora não sei identificar, que falou em espanhol, que existe, de facto, um problema de reinterpretação do direito marítimo internacional. Uma reinterpretação, uma vez que este direito muitas vezes nem sequer se encontra em linha com a legislação nacional de muitos Estados, o que, isso sim, coloca obstáculos à vertente operacional. E, portanto, é esta necessidade que existe de fazer convergir as respostas legais para as operações no terreno,
que consiste num trabalho, então, que continua a ser necessário desenvolver. É evidente que para que se atinja uma otimização em termos técnicos, é preciso trabalhar no terreno também com os países de origem e de trânsito. Portugal distingue-se particularmente nesta vertente, nomeadamente na formação que ministra aos serviços congéneres. Temos hoje um relacionamento primeiro com os guardas de fronteira de vários países da África Ocidental e não só, países cujos serviços de imigração, serviços congéneres, são serviços muito próximos, temos uma relação diária com os mesmos, falamos uma mesma linguagem técnica, partilhamos uma mesma matriz de segurança, uma vez que os problemas são similares e a busca de soluções tem que ser também partilhada. E, portanto, dizer que, inclusivamente, este problema passa cada vez mais pelo recurso a uma tecnologia que é coadjuvante da missão da Autoridade de Fronteira. Também, neste caso, Portugal se distingue por estar a disponibilizar esta tecnologia em vários quadrantes, não só a nível da União Europeia, mas fora da União Europeia, com as iniciativas que desenvolveu quanto aos sistemas automáticos de controle e registro de dados. E, portanto, passar esta mensagem que, de facto, há um trabalho que persiste, que é necessário, que é urgente e que passa por esta cooperação, por esta interação, por esta linguagem comum de trabalho, se assim posso dizer, e que, portanto, a União Europeia está particularmente empenhada nesta abordagem, desde os países de origem aos trânsitos e, obviamente, aos destinos. Muito obrigada.
Muito obrigado. Agora vamos passar à fase dos comentários por parte dos oradores. Pergunto se a nossa relatora prescinde de responder ou se na sua intervenção final englobará também algum comentário que julgue pertinente. Portanto, nós teríamos 5 minutos para cada dos oradores poder dar respostas straight to the point, concisas. Portanto, começamos pela senhora Ezeilo. 5 minutos, 5 minutos.
All right, thank you very much. I think I would like to focus, this is my last intervention, again on prevention, but quickly to the point John Greenway made. I also believe that women migrants need independent status, and that will provide them opportunities for legal, gainful, and also non-exploitative labor, because we have to understand the gender inequalities, power relations, even from where they are coming from, and how that disempowers them and doesn't give them the agency they need to speak about this. And that is the only way that will empower them and give them the opportunity to speak out about the exploitation they are facing. Regarding the issue of prevention, I would say that prevention can be approached as we embrace innovative and new approaches in two dimensions. One, prevention that will be specific to trafficking, such that we focus on awareness raising, issues of helplines, self-migration, working with the media and all of that. And then the broader approach is, again, that will recognize how trafficking is tied up to corruption, distorted migration, trade regimes, including systems that disempower women, children, migrants, and other vulnerable groups. And with specific, you invited me to give examples of how prevention, or good practice in prevention, especially from the perspective of a destination country. I think one of the things I often tell the state is that even when you develop prevention efforts, always subject that to evaluation. I went to one country on a mission. They have taken, there is a political will, and they've made enormous effort at prevention, including a lot of advertisements, billboards, and all. But when I also met victims, it turned out that was actually stigmatizing. So people don't even want to be recognized again as traffic victims. And this is a country that is a source country. So when people come back, especially, and huge number of men were also exploited, they wouldn't want to see themselves as victims or come out to the authorities and receive help, because it was so stigmatized. Everybody will know that they've gone abroad for prostitution, and for the men, and people were wondering, what the hell are you doing there? How come you got involved in this? So theirs was just, they have to just suffer in silence completely. So again, we need to rethink, you know, where we put out this information, and then how best, what channel are the most appropriate to use. For the young people, again, it is important to involve them in design, because you may see what appeals to adults channels are not the same channel that appeal to young people. You look at the use of ICT, which is increasingly what is also used to love victims. And we are not yet, in terms of prevention effort, using that channel effectively. Social network, Facebook, Twitter, how do we use that? How do we mobilize business communities, public-private partnership in prevention of trafficking? How do we, again, get the media involved, because distorted information can also be very negative or undermine the prevention effort. There are countries that are already using, you know, embassies abroad, having information on safe migration, helpline that is also very that respect people's privacy. All of that also work. Again, we need to also look at demand, and there have been new approaches with tackling demand as a root cause of trafficking, including what the Nordic countries are currently also doing in criminalizing of clients. Again, we need to also ensure that we don't just present trafficking as just sex trafficking or prostitution, but we also look at other aspects, including domestic servitude, that is increasingly a problem, of course, and which is even more insidious than, you know, to discover. So, you're looking at me, Chair, I think my time is up, but I think it's always, we need to really evaluate whatever measure that we have taken. It has to be in the national, if there's a national plan of action, we have to bring in all stakeholders. We need to get feedback whether this is working and what is not working, and we have to be prepared to change our strategy. But above all, destination countries, we need to work with source countries, have reintegration activities in source countries that will help to stem, you know, the problem right there. You know, and then for the source countries, they need to also, in their prevention efforts, have vocational education skills and training that will also tackle the root causes of trafficking. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Manuel Baus, também para as suas comentários finais.
Foram colocadas, e sem querer particularizar nenhuma em particular, eu referia algo que citei durante a minha intervenção e que penso que resume muito do que é a luta contra o tráfico de seres humanos. Quando eu referia que o tráfico de seres humanos assenta na teoria dos três P's, isto é, a prevenção, a punição e a proteção, e dizia eu que deveríamos acrescentar um quarto P, que é a das parcerias. Isto porque tendo em conta que hoje o tráfico de seres humanos não é uma questão localizada, não é uma questão nacional, é uma questão, como eu referi, globalizada ao nível do próprio planeta, daí que as parcerias são, de facto, fundamentais para que se possa ter um resultado eficaz contra a luta de tráfico de seres humanos. Me referia também que, e isto foi também de alguma forma explicado nas várias questões que foram colocadas, na questão dos instrumentos jurídicos que existem hoje a nível internacional e a dificuldade que há de transformação ou da aplicação prática desses mesmos instrumentos jurídicos. O entendimento que tem sobre esta matéria é que nunca respeita, e diria que se tem feito um trabalho eficaz do ponto de vista legislativo, do ponto de vista ao nível dos vários fóruns, quer seja das Nações Unidas, da própria União Europeia, do Conselho da Europa, dos vários grupos de trabalho que a este nível se têm encontrado, têm de facto saído instrumentos que, de alguma forma, cobrem o espectro daquilo que é a luta contra o tráfico de seres humanos. A questão diferente, e foi de alguma forma abordado por todos também, é a sua aplicação na prática, isto é, as medidas concretas, ou aquilo que nós chamamos as boas práticas. E neste caso, e falando aqui na qualidade de representante de Portugal, neste painel, se me permite, Sr. Presidente, Obviamente terei que referir aqui as boas práticas que Portugal tem tido em todas estas dimensões, isto é, quer ao nível da prevenção, quer ao nível da punição, quer ao nível da proteção, nomeadamente da proteção das vítimas, e como referi, com o exemplo concreto que dei durante a intervenção, quer ao nível das próprias parcerias. De facto, Portugal tem tido uma política ativa no que respeita à prevenção. E aí, não só as campanhas que se têm feito e que têm levado a efeito a objetivos e resultados muito concretos no que respeita a esta mesma prevenção, eu citei esta campanha Não Está Já à Venda, e que de facto abrangeu um leque enorme de pessoas direcionadas para a questão concreta das crianças, que é algo que obviamente nos preocupa a todos, mas também estamos atentos a outras formas de tráfico de seres humanos, nomeadamente da questão laboral, prevenindo fenómenos futuros que possam vir a acontecer, e daí que não é por acaso que eu referi durante a minha intervenção também a questão da servidão doméstica, que é de facto um fenómeno que não diria que é novo, porque este fenómeno da servidão doméstica, mas é um fenómeno para o qual hoje estamos todos mais atentos, está em crescendo e obviamente que devemos tomar medidas do ponto de vista da prevenção neste sentido, e de facto Portugal está atento e está a tomar medidas concretas no que respeita a esta questão da prevenção, nomeadamente relativamente a determinados fenómenos, porque muitas vezes quando falamos na questão do tráfico, falamos e ligamos muitas vezes à questão das mulheres, à exploração sexual e à exploração das crianças. Esquecemos da exploração laboral, que é algo que está em crescendo, e dentro da exploração laboral há algumas especificidades muito concretas, como é o caso concreto desta da servidão doméstica, que abrange, obviamente aqui, já não tanto do ponto de vista do explorador, e como referi, é de difícil investigação pelos elementos concretos que tem e pela complexidade que envolve, até pelas próprias características do exercício da atividade do trabalho doméstico, mas que, mesmo assim, não nos deve deixar desatentos e estarmos alertas quanto a esta questão. No ponto de vista da punição, as alterações legislativas que foram feitas, nomeadamente recentemente, quer em termos da Lei da Organização Criminal Portuguesa, quer em termos do Código Penal, quer em termos do Código do Processo Penal, levam, e aqui falo de boas práticas de Portugal no que respeita à questão da punição, do ponto de vista não apenas legislativo recente, mas também do ponto de vista da prática das próprias forças e serviços de segurança que têm competência da investigação destes crimes e que já levou à condenação desde a entrada e, sobretudo, à alteração legislativa que foi feita, já levou à punição efetiva de indivíduos com base neste novo crime, que tipificado este novo crime de tráfico de seres humanos. Mas também aqui, em termos de boas práticas e no que respeita à lei de organização criminal e, sobretudo, no que respeita às prioridades da investigação criminal em Portugal, o tráfico de seres humanos aparece como um dos crimes de investigação prioritário, o que, do nosso ponto de vista, é consubstanciar na prática aquilo que os instrumentos internacionais nos referem, os alertas que os instrumentos internacionais nos dão e que, no caso português, e referindo-me concretamente à questão da punição, nós vamos à prática, nomeadamente estabelecendo como um dos crimes de investigação prioritária nos termos da lei criminal portuguesa. Proteção.
Peço que termine
já com esta. Com a questão da proteção, para dizer que a recente alteração e as mais recentes alterações da lei de imigração portuguesa também prevêem, efetivamente, a proteção das vítimas de tráfico de seres humanos, nomeadamente através de regimes específicos na concessão da autorização de residência para as vítimas que são objeto do tráfico de seres humanos e também no incentivo de essas vítimas colaborarem com as autoridades no sentido de se proceder a uma melhor investigação. Por último, Sr. Presidente, a questão da parceria, não perderia mais tempo. O nosso exemplo da parceria que temos ao nível da Cplp é um exemplo claro de uma boa prática no que respeita a esta matéria, que, desta forma, fecha este ciclo dos 4 P's que nos devem orientar na luta contra o tráfico de seres humanos. Muito obrigado.
Ela fala por si. Fala por si, a parceria.
Agora temos o Sr. Peter von Eppen-Falvey for the final remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I fully agree with my with the speakers just before, with with Manuel Jamela Palos, director of the National Service for Aliens and Frontiers, and also, of course, I agree with John Gozzi-Tiello, the special rapporteur, what they said. The civic society must get more support in its work. This is very clear. But we should also not forget that such platforms like here, like created by the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, is very important for the exchanges and to identify gaps and to strengthen our work, should it be in prevention or prosecution or protection of victims. So I think, looking back of the 15 years of work Europe has done, we should be quite proud for that, what we have done for the witness protections, for the victims protection. We are already moving towards a new directive on the EU level, which is enlarging the scope of the protection. Yes, we will have in the future practical problems, which were mentioned by some of you, but we have to deal with it. On the other hand, I again repeat, this platform and future similar platforms should allow us to point out positively and critically the gaps. Of course, to protect victims means also to bring the perpetrators to the justice, and it's sometimes unacceptable that you walk on the streets of Vienna, of Brussels, of Berlin, on Rome, you protect the victims, at the same time you find on the streets the perpetrators of crime, and we have very little prosecution. This is also clear. In Germany, for example, the prosecution for last year went up of the perpetrators of crime in 10%. In some of the EU, all the EU member states, we have almost zero prosecution. What does it mean? It doesn't mean that our institution doesn't work, but there is a problem, and we have to touch it. We still have a little information on the labor market, on the exploitation of the labor market. We should not just simply put the problem, let me understand, I'm not criticizing any intervention, but we should not put it in the category of smuggling of people. We know about this, but the longitudinal and the sustainable effects of crime, of trafficking, and the labor market is a different one, and we have to see the effects of it, the damaging our tax system, our labor system, our social system, as a protective way, and see, of course, the other side, the human rights of the individual. The last point is, politically, I think we have done policy-wise and politically a lot, but we have to, I'm speaking now as a citizen, we have to keep up our politicians and policymakers alive with this category of problems. Today, in Europe, you see a decline. If you compare it with the beginning of 2000, 10 years ago, you have a decline. This is not anymore a priority. And not because we have no statistics. We have no statistics. Ask the Eurostat for providing statistics. The same reply, almost the same reply as 10 years ago. We helped them. We helped also our member states to compile the statistics. It's an immensely difficult crime to put it in terms of statistics and numbers. We are still with the same figure of Mrs. Gradin of 1995, 500,000 to 700,000 traffic. Where it comes from, it's probably from the air. But it doesn't matter. But we have the problem. It's a hidden crime, and I repeat that we should just have more sensitivity also towards the third countries, the victims, the cooperation with the society, as the Director General said, and we should, of course, see how to support the work of NGOs in Europe to come to a good conclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. E finalmente, vamos ouvir agora a nossa relatora, Sra. Joana von Heldorf, que nos vai sumarizar um pouco aquilo que foram as ideias-chave, as ideias mais importantes que aqui foram lançadas. Tem até o máximo 10 minutos, já combinámos entre nós que quando for 7 minutos já sabe que faltam 3, e nós de facto vamos acabar perfeitamente a tempo com a satisfação geral daqueles que vão de vir e daqueles que entretanto falaram. Portanto, tenho a palavra.
Thank you very much. Well, what seems to me is that there are certain points on which everybody agree. I think this is absolutely indisputable, that this is a global phenomenon, that trafficking is of a global proportion and it's also triggered by the globalization, so that the root causes somehow are in a fast and movement of people and all the opportunities, but also the dangers that the globalization is offering. And we are confronted with a very complex phenomenon. So trafficking is something that cannot be looked at from one side. It should be looked from many sides. So this multidisciplinary approach is absolutely crucial, because it has, as we have heard, it has a human rights approach aspect, it has a criminal justice approach aspect, it has a labor approach aspect, and it has a health approach aspect. To make everybody or to work together from at the national level, at the international level, it's really a huge task. And I think that we all agree that there is a panoply of international instruments. There is also a good national legislation, which is at least which is adopted at the national level. So the instruments that we have are enough. Probably to confront this phenomenon. The problem is that the phenomena is a moving target. It's not something which is stable. So we, at the beginning of even my work with trafficking, it was really mainly a sexual exploitation which we were confronted with. We are seeing now that we are moving towards labor exploitation, which is more and more present. We are seeing that we see different patterns, which are For instance, this is the domestic violence and domestic exploitation, which is now beyond and so hidden beyond diplomatic immunity that we cannot even get statistics. So, statistics, just let me say two words about this, are difficult. We all agree that it's a difficult way to gather statistics. It's a difficult to agree on a main indicator. So what do we look at when we gather statistics? And then on the top of it, it's also now increasingly difficult to gather statistics about the labor exploitation. We have also heard that what is absolutely crucial is that there are three P's, as we all know. But among these three P's, I would really strengthen prevention, which has been said several times as something which should be particularly looked at. And when we look at the prevention, then we have to look at the cooperation. So with three P's should be coordinated and combined with three C's, because we said three P's: prevention, prosecution, and it should be combined with the cooperation, coordination, and the capacity. That requires cooperation, and that requires the coordination with third countries. The third countries, which are the countries of origin, and we have to combat root causes. And when I say combating root causes, that means combating gender inequality, that means combating poverty, that means also looking particularly at very vulnerable victims, which are children and minors. What I have also heard is that we need innovative approach. But innovative approach, we have already a lot of things. So what should be innovative? It should be perhaps the angles from which we approach this phenomena to begin with, the combination of things, the balancing of things, the balancing between human rights approach and the security approach. And as we have heard, this is not incompatible. This should be going together. So criminal justice approach combined with a human rights approach is absolutely not compatible. It should be dealt with together, and this is how we can obtain results. But the innovation is probably the most challenging way to bring innovation forward would be to how to implement everything that we have. So we have a lot of things on our disposal, but the innovation consists in how do we best implement what we have and how do we coordinate. We have also heard that what is absolutely important is still training and awareness raising. But in this awareness raising, it's also because it's a moving target and because there are some new forms of trafficking which are coming up, then the awareness raising should be also adapted to this. So it shouldn't be awareness raising as it was 10 years ago, but it should also combine first new methods, new technologies. We should also know whom we are addressing. This awareness raising programs are there to youth people, so to find the channels how to approach those who we want to be better informed. We have heard that the global approach and the cooperation at the international level is very important. We have heard of some good practices, and I would strengthen and outline this Portuguese speaking countries project, which is covering four continents, so which is really embracing a large community under the motto "You are not for sale," and this is also an example of good cooperation and how we should maybe approach this phenomenon. Raising awareness means also approaching schools, making trafficking part of the curricula. What was also striking is that after the statistics, only in this sample of 13,000 children who were asked about what do they know about trafficking, only 6% knew what the trafficking is. This absolutely proves that awareness raising and targeting children as a potential group who should be absolutely aware of this, there is still work to be done. I'm warned that I have only 2 minutes, so I will just wind up saying that there is at the European level there are new chances that we are offered to now. There is a Lisbon Treaty, there are new potentials and also an institutional structure with the Parliament having more power, and that the new posts which are now created, like a EU anti-trafficking coordinator, should probably looked at carefully. But we certainly do have possibilities to tackle this phenomenon. Finally, I will just wind up by saying that there is also an important thing. Addressing trafficking as an external phenomenon, so strengthening cooperation with third countries, means also involving people from not only from internal affairs, but also from foreign ministries. But to do this, we have to change their mindset as well. So we have to. So the awareness raising is not only awareness raising of potential victims, but also of people who are dealing at or who should be dealing with this phenomenon to make it to improve the results. And also just to finish, instruments like monitoring instruments in the Council of Europe should be used. And when we say prevention, and with all instruments that we have to employ against trafficking, definitely have to be constantly evaluated to see whether we are really on a right path.
Vou falar em inglês, precisamente porque estava a olhar para a minha colega Corinne Juncker, and I want to apologize. This is a unique experience. Probably this is the only parliament in the world where the parliamentarians have the chance to have a solarium on their faces. So when you go back to Holland and somebody asks you, what have you been doing in Portugal? You just say, I was out in the beach. I was having sunshine in the parliament of Portugal. Secondly, I would like to give my thanks to our dearest guests and speakers, Mrs. Ezeilo, o Sr. Paulos, Mr. Betan Favli, and our rapporteur, Mrs. Elena von Heldorf. They have given us a huge contribution for the quality of this debate. I'm sorry if I was really too much tough with the timings, but I am Portuguese, and there are some Portuguese that they pay attention to timing. We like to be in time, to start in time, and to end in time. And then finally, I will give you some practical informations, and they are relevant and important. I would say it in English and in Portuguese. First information, primeira informação. O almoço, lunch, will be served on the ground level of this building. So you just go down by the stairs, and then you will find where is lunch. Of course, when the works will finish. Because before lunch, antes do almoço, nós teremos o panel D, workshop D, will be here in this room. Será aqui no Senado. Workshop E will be on the Salão Nobre. We follow the plaques. Portanto, será no Salão Nobre o painel E. Now, another and last information, uma última informação. Peço-vos que antes do coffee break, before coffee break, please follow me up to the entrance of the Parliament. Sigam-me até à entrada do Parlamento, porque nos foi pedido que tirássemos uma foto de família. We were asked to take a family picture in front, in the stairs in front of the main entrance of the Parliament. So before coffee break, please just follow me. Muito obrigado a todos. Thank you very much for your contribution.
I was asked to respect timetable at 1 p.m. We have to finish because of the most important point of today's program, lunch break. So we have only 70 minutes for presentations, discussions and summary. So let me start. This workshop will be interpreted into English and Portuguese, as I understood. And we will discuss on xenophobia and racism against migrants, first of all. It's my great pleasure to introduce you to my colleague from CDMG, from Council of Europe Committee for Migration, Mrs. Katarina Levchenka from Ukraine. She will play a role as rapporteur this morning and also later in the afternoon. On my left hand, there is Mr. Miros Muzniaks, originally from Latvia, but today he is as chair of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, ECRI. He will be our first panelist. And on my right hand, Mr. Gitu Muigai, originally from Kenya, but today as United Nations Special Rapporteur on contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance, as second panelist. Let me make proposal of organization of this workshop. We will start by two short panelists' presentations between 10-15 minutes. And after each presentation, I will ask your immediate flash reactions or urgent questions for immediate answer. And after that, we will open more general debate, not only questions, but also proposals, points of view from you. And finally, Katarina will make a brief summary as our rapporteur. And later, after lunch, there will be a plenary report back from our two parallel workshops at 2:30. My role is relatively simple, is to moderate this session, if necessary to provoke lively and, if possible, interactive discussion, despite this big space for several hundred people, and to arrange our reporter a rich material for her later presentation. Let me start in a more personal way in 2 minutes. I'm coming from Prague, and my baptism was in the Church of St. Anthony in Prague. And my first trip to Portugal, to Lisbon, was on 13 June 2000. It is, according to Catholic calendar, St. Anthony Day. And as you know, St. Anthony is a patron of lost relationships, values, and also property. And my luggage was lost in Lisbon on St. Anthony Day. So I said, "St. Anthony, do anything." And my luggage was found in 3 hours. So I'm on the right place. So, Nils, it's your floor for your first presentation.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor and pleasure for me to be here in Portugal. It's my first time, and it's a especially great honor to share the podium with my colleague from the UN, who I've never met before. And if I thought I had big headaches covering 47 countries, I can imagine the size of the headaches my colleague from the UN has, covering the whole world. I want to look at how ECRI, the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, views these issues of migration, racism, and intolerance. But I want to start by talking very briefly. I only have 12 slides, and two of them are pictures, so I will be brief, about ECRI, because I discovered, much to my surprise, that there are a number of people here who had never heard of ECRI, had no idea what ECRI was and what it does and how it works. So, briefly, one short slide on ECRI stands for the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, and it is the Council of Europe's independent racism monitoring body. Independent insofar as it's composed of 47 members nominated by the countries. They do not take instructions from their governments. And ECRI works throughout all of the Council of Europe states, all 47 states, and the core of our work is country-by-country monitoring. What we do is we prepare regular reports, comprehensive reports, on each of the Council of Europe's member states, covering issues such as legislation, equality bodies, discrimination in various fields, the situation of vulnerable groups, the climate of opinion, the conduct of law enforcement. And these reports are the product of a lot of work. Each of them takes about a year to prepare, based on a lot of documentation, based on a country visit, interviews with all of the relevant authorities, and then dialogue with the government. The second aspect of our work is work on general themes. And outside in the hallway, you can see the results of some of our work. They're general policy recommendations. And we've done 11 of them, 12 of them so far, and two of them are available outside. Our most popular one, which is on model national legislation against racism and discrimination, where we give a very detailed overview of what, in our opinion, is the best practice in terms of anti-discrimination legislation. And these are used by national authorities, by NGOs, by various bodies, for lobbying, for education, and for combating racism and intolerance. And the third aspect of our work is relations with civil society. We not only gather information from civil society, of course we have to treat it sometimes with a grain of salt, because we have to check and double check the information, but civil society is a very important partner for us in getting the message out. And we generally organize, after doing a country report, we organize a round table within the country to bring together the authorities and NGOs and all the stakeholders. We take a very broad approach to racism, and our definition is, racism is a belief that race, which we put in inverted commas, color, language, religion, nationality, or national ethnic origin justify contempt for a person or the notion of superiority of a group of persons. So in other words, we paint with a very broad brush, which allows us to look at issues and forms of discrimination and forms of intolerance that certain treaty-based bodies cannot do. Our definition of racial discrimination is similarly broad. It covers both direct and indirect discrimination, and the grounds include not only race, color, and national or ethnic origin, but also nationality, meaning citizenship, religion, and language. And this, I should point out, goes beyond what the EU anti-discrimination directives foresee. What are the trends that we see in our country-by-country work affecting migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees? After the terrorist attacks of 9/11, of course, we saw the discourse linking immigrants with crime and terrorism assume a new stridency, and certain aspects of anti-terrorist policies also highlight, sometimes in a negative way, certain groups of minorities, immigrants, or refugees. And here I'm speaking about racial and ethnic profiling. Racial and ethnic profiling before 9/11 had been largely discredited as a violation of human rights, but it came back with a vengeance in the context of anti-terrorism. And we've done a lot of work on this, looking both at the situation within countries, but also we've developed some guidelines in General Policy Number 11 on policing and combating racism. We've seen a hardened tone of immigration and the debate about immigrant integration, and this is especially true in the context of the economic crisis. Whereas initially people talked about the need to integrate or the right to integrate, what we've seen more recently is talk of the duty to integrate and sometimes the obligation to integrate. And if this obligation is not fulfilled, certain sanctions are sometimes imposed by governments, and this is highly problematic, and this is something that we look at quite closely. Then, of course, we have the linkage of the issue of asylum to abuse in the public debate. We've talked a lot about that over the last day and a half, which has led to restrictions of rights, detention, and ironically, EU expansion has done little to improve the situation here, but it has actually led to, in our view, a decline in standards of protection in a number of the new EU member states. So EU enlargement has not solved all of our problems here. It's sometimes even made them worse. Not only do we look at countries on a regular basis, all the countries in the Council of Europe, but occasionally a situation draws our attention and we take a stand on an urgent situation. And we've done so recently three times. And all three times the issue was related to situations concerning migrants of various kinds. The first was in late 2006, where we adopted a statement on an official campaign in Russia, a campaign of detentions, deportations, and harassment versus Russian citizens of Georgian origin, of whom many were also Georgian citizens, migrant workers within Russia. That was the first time outside of our regular cycle of work we addressed this issue. In mid-2008, we adopted a statement on Italy in the midst of a high-level campaign aimed at Romanian immigrants, most of whom were Roma, and other immigrant communities within Italy, in which there was a campaign of hate speech, in which many high-level political officials were involved, and various discriminatory measures. And most recently, in late 2009, we adopted a statement on Switzerland in the context of the Swiss referendum against minarets. And here you can see one of the campaign posters that was used in this campaign. It portrays minarets in the form of missiles endangering Switzerland, the woman with the burqa, and this campaign was surrounded by stigmatization of Muslims and immigrants in a way that was that undermined their equality, and the authorities, in our view, did not do enough to counter this campaign. What are the solutions that we see? We spent a lot of time looking at legislation, both international legislation and domestic legislation. Of course, we urge countries not only to ratify but to implement these instruments, starting with ICERD, the Convention on the Participation of Foreigners in Public Life, of which only 8 Council of Europe countries have ratified, and of course, Protocol 12, which extends protection against discrimination in new ways within the Council of Europe member states. Only 17 Council of Europe countries have ratified this instrument. We find it to be a very important instrument. We contributed to the drafting of this instrument, and just recently, last year, the European Court of Human Rights ruled for the first time on a violation of Protocol 12 in the Sejdic and Finci case. Further, we look at national legislation, and our general policy recommendation number 7 on model national legislation is available outside on the table. We, in terms of the context of this conference, nationality or citizenship as a prohibited ground of discrimination is a very important issue. I did a review in preparing for this conference of our recent country reports and noted that only about half of the Council of Europe member countries that we've covered lately have nationality as a prohibited ground of discrimination. We also look at civil and administrative law, which is the most accessible remedy to victims of discrimination. And here we put a big focus on issues of shifting or sharing the burden of proof between the person complaining and the defender. If there's a good case, if there's a good case in terms of data that discrimination has taken place, then the burden of proving the discrimination has not taken place shifts to the defendant. And of course, criminal law against incitement, against the denial or trivialization of genocide, in terms of banning racist organizations, but also in terms of making racism an aggravating circumstance for normal violations or all other violations. But of course, legislation is not enough. We must look at implementation. And here, of course, training is critical. We look at the nature and content and extent and availability of training, including for border guards, staff at detention centers, civil servants dealing with immigrants. We look at, in terms of addressing racial and ethnic profiling, usually this requires a broader, more institutional approach, and we recommend policy audits and research to address patterns of racial and ethnic profiling that might be unintentional, that might not be based on racism, but they have just somehow gotten into the regular practice and operational procedures of law enforcement. We look again at strengthening equality bodies, national human rights institutions, ombudsmen, so that they can represent victims in courts and act without a known victim. And we stress the importance of data collection. Ethnic data broken down by ethnicity, language, country of origin, as being a critical tool for monitoring policy, but also for proving discrimination. But we also take a broader perspective. We look at, especially in terms of immigrant refugee integration, as being a two-way process of mutual recognition involving the majority and various minority groups. And we look a whole lot at the climate of opinion, because a climate of opinion can critically affect the success or failure of integration in a country. Here we look at the media and political discourse in particular, which can have a huge impact on integration processes in society. In our view, non-discrimination and the promotion of equality are critical components in any successful integration strategy, because discrimination is a barrier to integration. We look also very frequently at issues concerning the acquisition of legal status by immigrants, asylum seekers, and refugees. In our own view, lawful residence in a country is a prerequisite for integration. Without lawful residence, there's a danger of exploitation. The lack of documents prevents the exercise of rights by various groups. In terms of stability of these residence rights, this is a long-term perspective is important also for integration. It can promote integration, and this means having residency permits of reasonable duration, allowing for family reunification and so on. And finally, facilitating naturalization so that immigrants and refugees can acquire the same rights as nationals. And again, this is a guarantee against deportation. And of course, in Europe, we see these issues play out in very different ways in different parts of Europe, but they are topical everywhere. In Southern Europe, we've heard a lot of discussion about the migration pressures, especially coming from across the Mediterranean. Many East European countries, including my own, are only now becoming countries of immigration and asylum, and this process is also connected with very many strains and difficulties, and it's a big learning process, not only for the civil servants, the politicians, but also for the public at large. There are some countries we see that are trying to avoid discussions about immigration, asylum seekers, and refugees altogether. In our view, this is very short-sighted, and I think this picture shows very well what kind of a policy this is. Yesterday, I talked a bit about the need to reclaim the debate about migration and asylum from the extreme right, who loves this debate and it's bread and butter for the extreme right. I think we really need a human rights-based debate on migration, asylum, and refugees. We need to involve the migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees and listen to them. We need to include anti-racism and non-discrimination in our integration policies, and we need to learn from others. Both we need to learn what to avoid, but there are many, many good practices in Europe that can help us address these challenges, which we are all facing in various ways. And for more information on best practices, I can recommend ECRI reports and our general policy recommendations. And with that, I will close. Thank you.
Thank you, Nils. I have to confirm from perspective of my country, we have a long-term experience with your organization. We cooperate with preparing country profiles, and it's really deep and competent sonde into our situation. But I have to protect ostriches. On your picture, it's not true that they make a hat under the sand. My close friend, ambassador of the Czech Republic in Latvia, in translation, his name is Ostrich, and he protested many times. So, my question, if you have some immediate reactions, questions oriented to Nils after his first presentation, it's a good time. Yes.
Well, Mr. Nils, thank you very much for your presentation. I will speak in English for you, I think it's best. My name is Vasco Malta. I'm a legal advisor. I work with the High Commissioner for Immigration and Intercultural Dialogue in Portugal. So I will have two questions for you. The first one is, when do you think it will be the next report on Portugal? Because I think the last one was in 2006, and I think probably it will be a new one very sooner. And, well, the second question is regarding our experience. If you think the actual economic crisis will make worse the legal framework around all country Europeans regarding the anti-discrimination laws. Thank you very much.
Yes, regarding Portugal, the cycle until now has been a 5-year cycle, so we have to cover all 47 countries. So I can't remember by memory when it is, but it should be, I think, over the next year. One new practice that we have introduced to try to shorten this time span is something we call interim follow-up, where 2 years after the publication of a report, now in this current cycle, we go back to the country and we say, what have you done over the last 2 years? And we don't, not on all issues, but in the reports, we're in the fourth round of reports, we try to identify 3 priority issues, which are the most urgent issues from our perspective, but about which we have an impression by talking with the government that there is a possibility of making progress in 2 years and reporting to us. So now we are just beginning this process of going back now 2 years after the report. So we're trying to make it our contacts with the authorities of various countries more frequent, but Portugal is coming up very soon. Regarding the economic crisis and discrimination, I think we have commissioned a study on the economic crisis and its impact on racism and discrimination. But a number of trends, I think, are already clear. One is that equality bodies are being weakened, anti-discrimination bodies. I was just addressed by a coalition of NGOs and the head of an equality body whose budget is being slashed, whose mandate is being narrowed, asking for ECRI to take a stand on this issue. And we think this is highly unfortunate, because in the context of the economic crisis, the clients of these equality bodies are the most hard hit. These are immigrants, these are minorities of various kinds, in particular Roma. Not only that, but various programs benefiting these groups are being cut. So we see this as being a dangerous situation, especially because the climate of opinion in the context of economic crisis makes for peddling fear, looking for scapegoats, and blaming migrants and minorities for problems. So this is a very disturbing trend. It's playing out in different ways across Europe, but these are some of the broad trends we see, and they're of serious concern to us.
Thank you. Any other question?
Yes.
Bom dia. O meu nome é Romualda Fernandes, eu sou adjunta da Secretária de Estado da Administração Interna, ligada mais ou menos nestas áreas das migrações. A pergunta que eu quero fazer tem exatamente a ver com o conceito que estamos aqui a debater, no fundo, quando falamos do racismo, da xenofobia. E a questão que ponho é exatamente saber até que ponto continuamos a utilizar a raça quando se trata destas questões, que evolução é que esse conceito já teve, porque lembro-me de ter participado nas discussões sobre a negativa raça na União Europeia e em 2001. E uma das questões que prevou mais o avanço a nível dos grupos de questão social era exatamente este conceito de raça. Queria saber que evolução é que esse trabalho teve. Obrigada.
As I said, we usually, when we mention the term race, we usually put it in inverted commas, because we do not endorse any ideology or theory that there is more than one race of human beings. Human beings are all one race. But this is so as not to leave people outside of protection. What are the trends in terms of racism is a constantly changing phenomenon that affects different groups. This is why I feel fortunate that we don't have a convention that keeps us within a narrow understanding of racism, that we can adapt our work to changing manifestations of racism over time. But I do think racism has always been a combination of beliefs about biology and beliefs about culture and the links between them. And if before the focus was more on biology, on theories of superiority based on biology, very often now racism is not framed at all in terms of biology. You hear the argument, we're not better or worse than them, we're just different. We're so different that we can't live together. They have their own mentality, their lifestyle, and it's perfectly fine. It's equal to ours, it's of equal worth, but they just don't mix with us too well. So they should stay out of the country. If we let them in, we should not let them mix. This is a kind of racism you encounter very often. And the groups targeted by racists and discrimination and tolerance change and evolve over time. And some groups, for a while, they're very vulnerable, all of a sudden move up the ladder a bit, and new groups emerged to being on the bottom of the heap. So it's a constantly evolving phenomenon that we have to keep an eye on and monitor. But we continue to use the term race and racism, but as I said, with a lot of qualifiers.
Thank you. And Luisa, in this moment, final flash reaction to Nils.
Obrigada. Eu gostaria de perguntar-lhe como é que acha que a ação intergovernamental do Conselho da Europa pode ser melhor organizada e com mais eficácia para dar eficácia às recomendações da Comissão Europeia contra o Racismo e a Intolerância. E neste contexto também gostava de lhe perguntar qual pensa que poderá ser o papel e o envolvimento do Comitê Diretor para as Migrações.
I've been at a lot of meetings over the last few months between different bodies within the Council of Europe. And I think this is a good thing that we didn't do earlier enough. And I think under the new Secretary General, he is prompting us to intensify our contacts within the monitoring directorate, between different bodies, with the Human Rights Commissioner, but I think that also with the Parliamentary Assembly. I addressed the Monitoring Committee of the Parliamentary Assembly, and I think there's a lot of productive work there. I think that we regularly receive your reports and find them quite useful in our work. I think that if you're looking at specific situations in countries or specific issues and would like ECRI input, we have 47 good experts with a wide variety of experience from all over the Council of Europe. We have an excellent staff of civil servants that can be of assistance, and I think that we might be able to provide more input into your work than has been the case until now. And what might be interesting also is to have these regular contacts before we go to a country and say, what is your information on the country involved in terms of migration, asylum, refugee, trafficking, detention, so on? Is there anything you want us to pay particular attention to? And then perhaps we can help you by bringing back information from the country visits. Because the country visits really provide us unique access to a country. We can go anywhere we want. We have meetings with all of the relevant players, and we have ongoing dialogue with the authorities, so we get information and data from them that we find to be very useful, and that could be useful for your committee as well. So I think there's a lot of room for improvement, and I'm happy to see that in the Council of Europe there's a lot of movement to create synergies in the context of the reform, austerity, and so on. But I think it's also long overdue, so I welcome it.
Thank you, Nils, and all who debate in this moment. And let me invite Githu Muigai, UN Special Rapporteur, to his presentation. It's your floor.
Ladies and gentlemen, first I want to begin by thanking the Government of Portugal, the Council of Europe, and the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for inviting me to this meeting. As we have heard since the beginning of this conference, migration is undoubtedly one of the most challenging issues of the 21st century. It is a challenge because it is growing in scale and it is having profound changes in our societies. We are reminded often that we live in a global village, but the promise of a peaceful, harmonious, integrated village has not been achieved. There is a major human rights dimension to the issues that surround migration. Migrants face significant challenges. They encounter obstacles because of the differences in language, in customs, in culture, in the lack of awareness of their rights, as well as the social and economic circumstances from which they operate. As a result, we are all aware that migrants are exposed to grave human rights violations, abuses that include racial discrimination and xenophobia. Most of us are aware that there is an intricate interrelationship between race and dimension, race and migration, whose historical dimension probably we do not have time to go into now, and maybe we'll deal with in the discussion. One of the main problems, as I see it, of the challenge of migration today is that there are many otherwise responsible governments and states that view migration as a problem. notwithstanding the evidence available everywhere that migration is a necessary way of rejuvenating societies everywhere. I have been, since I became rapporteur on racism, it's been my great fortune to travel to several countries in many parts of the world. I've been to Germany, I've been to the United Arab Emirates, I've been to Singapore, and in all these countries and other countries, it's been very difficult to persuade governments that they do actually need informed, progressive migration policies that are human rights based, because it is in their own interests, not in the interests of migrants. We have societies with declining birth rates in Europe that still operate on the basis that their main policy is to keep out migrants. In my own view, this is an unfortunate and an uninformed position that I am happy the meeting we have today seeks to address. Sometimes the problem of migration is depicted as a North-South problem. It is depicted as a problem of Africans and Asians and South Americans trying to get into Europe and America and Canada and so on. This is not true. I know we have, as we saw the other day in Rossano in Italy, this is what television captures, this is what television sensationalizes. But the problem of migration and the xenophobia surrounding it knows no borders. And most of you will remember that last November in South Africa, we had very violent, very ahistorical xenophobic attacks of probably some of the most vulnerable peoples in the world. These are migrants from Zimbabwe who were subjected to very brutal and xenophobic attacks inside Africa by Africans. And I think that serves to remind us and to remind those who think that we are looking at a geographical problem that we actually are not. One of the arguments I have heard in many countries that I have visited is the argument that the sovereign rights of states to determine how they will manage their countries in the best interest of their citizens cannot be compromised for the benefit of migrants and foreigners. In fact, in my most recent visit, I have had governments say to me in very clear and apologetic terms, if foreigners do not like the way we treat them here, why don't they stay in their own countries? This is a very dangerous notion. Obviously, we must start by admitting that the very essence of a nation state is that it should serve its own nationals in the first place, and I do not think that is an argument as to whether the state should serve its own citizens as against foreigners. But I do myself believe most profoundly that the way we run the modern state must be consistent with our own obligations under international law and our own commitments in relation to applicable international human rights standards, norms, etc., etc. And in this regard, I would like to remind you, ladies and gentlemen, of the provisions of the Durban Declaration and Programme of Action and the Durban Review Conference Outcome Document, which recognizes racism and xenophobia as one of the most challenging aspect of the enforcement of a global human rights instrument. In Europe, regrettably, while Europe has led historically in expanding the frontiers of freedom and in accommodating different nationalities and making them feel at home. Recent historical experiences, probably starting with the collapse of the Berlin Wall and with other factors that I have no time to go into, has seen the re-emergence and a re-energization of extreme right-wing parties. And I have traveled in parts of the world where I have seen these parties that unashamedly propagate an anti-immigration, anti-foreigner, extreme far-right nationalistic position. I believe myself that they challenge a fundamental tenet of European civilization. I believe that they make a problem that we can together tackle that much more difficult by introducing elements that do not belong to this debate. I believe myself that we must continue to provide education and more education, because I believe intolerance is basically an upshot of bigotry, and bigotry is essentially about lack of information, lack of awareness, in which individuals see in other people a challenge, a threat to their way of life, their way of thought, their religions, and so on and so forth. I believe as well, ladies and gentlemen, that the debate sometimes proceeds on the basis that governments should do things, states should do things. I believe that governments alone will never tackle this problem. We need to energize civil society organizations. We need to energize international and regional bodies, and I'm happy that my colleagues are here, and that they and we in the UN system are reading from the same script, because I believe that that is the right way to go in order to address these issues. I commend again the organizers of this conference, and I and my mandate stand quite ready to continue engaging in this dialogue and to share our experiences. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Githu, for your presentation. And the same procedure, you know this TV sketch, the same procedure as in the first presentation, if you have some immediate reactions or questions to our second panelist. If not, we can open more general discussion. I forgot to introduce myself. I represent here CDNG Bureau, but my responsibility at the Ministry of Interior of the Czech Republic is to support integration of foreigners and integration of recognized refugees. And it's our daily task in communication with municipalities, police, different ministries, offices, and different parts of society to explain migration policy and to prevent potential misunderstandings and possible hostile or xenophobic reactions. And I am proud that ultra-right party received during last weekend parliamentary elections less than 1% in my country, so they are out of parliament, out of power. The aim of this workshop is to formulate sets of recommendations for governments, international organizations, including Council of Europe, NGOs, and or identify policies, solutions for our states. Unfortunately, xenophobia and racism generally, and against migrants specifically, have to be still discussed and solved, and we are still faced by this phenomenon in our societies. Of course, I'm sure that state plays crucial role in combating against intolerance and peaceful coexistence of immigrants and host society. But on both sides, and Niels spoke about two-way process, on both sides must exist rights and duties, responsibility and tolerance and respecting the rules and laws. So try, please, in our debate to be concentrate concrete and specific in formulation of our recommendation and sharing experience. And maybe see also page 4 of the conference outline on this workshop. And let me misuse my position of somebody who has microphone, so somebody who debates, who is not a moderator in this moment. I would like to incorporate into set of recommendation 1 for Council of Europe specifically, because Githu started his presentation by important sentence that migration is one of the most challenging phenomenon of the 21st century, and it's dry fact, it's reality. So my proposal is to recommend Council of Europe to continue in solving problems of migration and integration, including combating xenophobia and racism, and in formulating recommendations for member states as an important instrument for creation of national policies in migration. So don't be afraid, I will continue in my long speech. So I am a moderator again, and it's your floor.
Obrigado, Sr. Presidente. Eu gostaria de pegar numa das partes do discurso do Sr. Muigai, quando referiu que é na educação que muito provavelmente tem que começar toda uma política de prevenção e de combate, também aqui em relação à xenofobia e em relação ao racismo. Eu refiro que desde muito tenra idade que se deve incutir no espírito das nossas crianças determinados valores, como a dignidade humana, mas também em relação à preservação de grandes patrimónios da humanidade. E, por exemplo, temos desde logo, que já foi em prática em vários países, no meu país, em Portugal também, com sucesso, que desde muito tenra idade nas escolas se criou sensibilidade ambiental. Ou seja, o tema do ambiente foi incutido como algo que é necessário preservar, portanto, a natureza, o respeito, a biodiversidade. E então, eu diria que desde a pré-primária às escolas primárias, nessa disciplina de currículo obrigatório que deveria incluir, portanto, esse respeito pela dignidade humana, mas também uma dimensão de género, e aqui, obviamente, também nesse respeito incluir os valores de uma sociedade multicultural, de uma sociedade plurirracial e de uma sociedade de entendimento e de cooperação entre pessoas de todas as cores, de todos os credos. Eu gostava que o Sr. Muigai, se possível, nos desse uma perspectiva sobre em que países é que ele conhece que esta experiência da educação de terra-idade já tenha sido posta em prática com sucesso. E o que é que aconselharia àqueles países que ainda não fizeram a fazerem? Portanto, se tem alguns aspectos práticos de como esta aprendizagem cívica e uma aprendizagem focalizada nos direitos humanos e no respeito entre os seres humanos, como é que ele vê que isso pudesse sair daqui como uma mensagem desta conferência para os países onde eventualmente ainda não esteja em prática esse tipo de atuação no sistema do ensino?
Thank you. Any other? Michel Dion.
Je vais parler en français.
Les politiques, effectivement, de lutte contre le racisme et la xénophobie sont des politiques à long terme. Je peux porter quelques expériences qui ont été développées en Belgique avec la mise en place depuis maintenant plus d'une vingtaine d'années d'un centre pour l'égalité des chances et la lutte contre le racisme. Ça a été un détonateur particulièrement important vis-à-vis de la classe politique d'une manière générale, parce que c'est le gouvernement qui a mis en place un dispositif de ce genre et qui a servi d'abord à faire toute une série d'analyses sectorielles pour voir les discriminations en matière d'éducation, discriminations en matière d'emploi, discriminations en matière de santé et ainsi de suite, pour essayer de faire cette analyse globale et puis faire des propositions pour aller de l'avant. Comme le président de l'ECRI l'a dit aussi, une dimension importante dans une certaine réussite contre la xénophobie et le racisme, les politiques qui ont été menées, c'était de faciliter l'acquisition de la nationalité du pays d'accueil. Parce que ça permet aussi à la classe politique du pays d'accueil, en tout cas à certains partis d'extrême droite principalement, c'était de dire, bon, tant qu'ils ne sont pas électeurs, on peut quelque part casser du sucre sur les migrants. À partir du moment où il y a un certain nombre d'électeurs qui deviennent, des migrants qui deviennent électeurs, ça devient un peu plus difficile. Et donc, en une vingtaine d'années, on a pu voir une évolution particulièrement importante. Et donc, je crois que ce serait intéressant de voir quels sont les pays aujourd'hui qui facilitent davantage l'acquisition de cette nationalité, parce que c'est un vecteur important, c'est pas le seul, bien entendu. La dimension de l'éducation, la dimension de la participation dans des organisations syndicales, dans un certain nombre de lieux, ou un échange, parce que la xénophobie et le racisme, c'est aussi lié à la non-connaissance de l'autre. Et donc, favoriser ce genre de rencontres entre populations autochtones et populations issues de l'immigration sont aussi des vecteurs importants. Voilà, un peu un commentaire, mais peut-être aussi sur les questions, quels sont les pays qui facilitent l'acquisition de cette nationalité, c'est aussi un aspect à ne pas négliger.
Thank you, Michel, and thank you also, our friends in these glass boxes, for exceptional French interpretation. And please keep, if possible, English and Portuguese languages. Before final words of our panelists and our rapporteur, let me invite you for additional questions and comments, because we have still some 5-10 minutes. Yes.
Thank you. I would really like to join this debate by focusing my intervention on sharing just some situations that I've experienced that also is happening. I was, when we talk about education and the role of the school or agents of socialization, it's important that we also rethink even what sort of information that those that are taught or in the curriculum of those schools. We're all aware that recently in Arizona they banned ethnic studies, and then of course there were a lot of protests and the arguments I was listening to both sides. One says it's also to avoid racism again, and then again promote maybe sort of general studies where people learn about other people and not cocoon people to their issues. There were merits I could see on both sides, but again, given also the recent policies of the government of the same state, I think people will also doubt their genuineness of that. And recently, about a few years back, I was also in San Diego, California, and I was invited to speak to children in minority schools, And what struck me after my message was the kind of questions I was receiving from these children. And I was also wondering, why would they have schools for minority? And I know, of course, encouraging this also is part of maybe what we also promote, that we also allow people to be able to express their language and also learn with culture. But I didn't find that to be from the question. Let me give you an example of some of the questions I received from the people. Some clearly children of African descent whose parents are Africans and of my race were even asking me, oh, you speak English? You know, where you live? You know, how did you learn English? And then when the teacher said, okay, we're going to send you email of the pictures we took, you mean you had email? You mean you know, so you can imagine the kind of information and what is being reinforced and things that can actually really contributes to feeling of superiority of a group of persons. And it's not just by race here now, it's also by geographical location. And like Gitu pointed out, sometimes when we look at this, we just look at it as issue of geography as by the north and the south of the world. But people can also be there of the same race, have totally entirely view. And that's set me really thinking about really the values or the things that we emphasize, and even within the education, which we know should promote tolerance and then eliminate all forms of racial discrimination, whether we are doing it right and whether people will like to really be very frank and open in discussions around that. And I would like to really get the response of the speakers to this. Again, on this issue of, and we know with regard to the issue of trafficking, that certain population, maybe indigenous group or certain race, are prone, you know, to being trafficked or also have forced to migrate because of difficulties they have in terms of access and opportunities, even in their own countries. And I don't know how, and women particularly within this group are more vulnerable, because even within that system, they still have the power relations and then the practices that are heavily weighted also against women. But I'm more concerned about the role of agents of socialization, the family, the school, and society. And sometimes, even when we preach one value in our family, when our children are also exposed to the school system, they come back with also other values. I once had my daughter say something, and I turned and I said, who taught you that about one ethnic group in my country, in Nigeria? And I said, who taught you that? And of course, the schools, you know, things that you don't want them to repeat about it, and you find that they already, even as they're growing up, things that we, even at our generation and with exposure, cannot do, you find them also reinforcing that, and that is really a challenge. And again, finally, on the issue of anti-terrorism move and the world we live in today, I the point you made about post 9/11, how that has changed the world. As a Nigerian, it doesn't matter, I'm the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Trafficking, and then, for example, you arrive in the U.S., and unfortunately, last Christmas, December 25th, bomb attempt on Delta Airline from Amsterdam to Detroit was by a Nigerian who, it doesn't really matter, he never really lived in Nigeria, but was school abroad all the time in England and had all the family set up and everything. But now you come with a policy that is supposed to find anti-terrorism that in itself amounts to racial discrimination and profiling, because you arrive US and then look at your nationality, and the first will be, they will write 4S, which is serious security suspect, you know. So then you are just that suspect, and then put in that mode. And I think it also raises a lot of questions about whether we are really winning this war or efforts, and whether these international standards, there is any intention whatsoever by states, especially when they use the omnibus security issue or terrorism, anti-terrorism efforts to as an excuse or justification for violation of human rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Joy. And I invite you for final two reactions, questions before summing up? Yes.
Muito bom dia. Eu sou vice-presidente do Conselho Geral da Ordem dos Advogados Portugueses e presidente da sua Comissão dos Direitos Humanos. Face a este interessante debate e ao tema que foi proposto, gostaria de colocar uma ou duas questões e enunciar uma outra. Um dos aspectos que me parece que poderia e deveria ser mais tratado, mais abordado, mais escalpelizado no campo da xenofobia e do racismo será precisamente o que respeita ao respeito ou à defesa, à salvaguarda das diferentes orientações sexuais. Cada vez mais se verifica uma situação de algum ataque, quando não diremos mesmo uma ostensiva perseguição, sobretudo em determinadas zonas geográficas do mundo, mas não só, também as chamadas zonas geográficas do pensamento e da inteligência de cada um dos seres humanos, neste domínio. Um outro aspecto será aquele que respeita àquilo que poderíamos chamar o racismo, entre comas, a xenofobia do ponto de vista ideológico. Este tipo de políticas, e sobretudo no comando das organizações internacionais que se dedicam ao estudo, à investigação, à defesa e à ação nestas matérias, parece-nos que deveria ser mais estudado, mais diversificado e, sobretudo, mais incisivo. Não só porque a defesa dos direitos humanos passa pela difícil, mas absolutamente indispensável compatibilização entre os direitos das diferentes minorias, mas também os direitos daquelas que, num dado momento circunstancial e apenas circunstancial, porque a maioria de hoje, seja ela qual for, a sua matriz será, eventualmente, amanhã, uma minoria, a possibilidade de compatibilizar, e para isso, efetivamente, existem um conjunto de elementos que devem ser utilizados e que o devem ser. Assim, parece-me que no campo das organizações internacionais, designadamente, e algumas daquelas têm uma intervenção ativa neste tipo de organização, cujo convite eu pessoalmente, Jerónimo Martins, e a organização que represento agradece, gostaria que, apesar das dificuldades que integram a chamada aplicação do que podemos designar como direito internacional neste domínio, e também noutros, fosse visto, entendido, ou de alguma forma sugerido pelos ilustres membros da mesa, que também aproveito para cumprimentar, bem como todos os presentes, que medidas ou que perspectivas existem nestes dois domínios que eu acabei de referir. Muito obrigado.
Thank you, and final words. Yes.
Now I'm going to speak in Portuguese. Bem, eu tenho o prazer de trabalhar com uma dimensão muito prática sobre estas questões do racismo e então, pegando nas palavras do Sr. Nils relativamente aos best practices, às melhores práticas, talvez seja esta uma oportunidade onde possa dar alguns exemplos de boas práticas que existem cá em Portugal, sendo certo que parte exatamente deste princípio, isto é, que é muito importante e ao longo de toda a possibilidade que eu tive de conhecer as melhores práticas de outros países, é muito importante poder beber a experiência que existe nos outros países relativamente a estas questões. Em Portugal, e eu começo exatamente por... é uma apresentação muito curta, mas eu começo exatamente por falar pela internet, porque, de facto, nos dias de hoje é talvez o meio de difusão dos movimentos racistas e discriminatórios e xenófobos, não só em Portugal, mas como em todo o mundo,
E eu realço exatamente uma ferramenta informática, digamos assim, que foi disponibilizada há cerca de um ano e meio em Portugal, que permite exatamente fazer a denúncia de sites ou blogs com teor racista, para que eles possam ser, dessa forma, automaticamente bloqueados após, obviamente, uma investigação sobre o seu conteúdo por parte das entidades competentes. Portanto, este é um instrumento muito importante, em Portugal, inclusive, e que penso que poderia ser utilizado, ou a sua, digamos assim, a sua experiência que esteve ao longo deste ano, poderia ser utilizada para outros países da União Europeia e não só, nesta forma de não fomentar este tipo de atitudes ou deste tipo de sites com teor racista e xenófobo. Depois, exatamente como disse o Dr. José Mendes Bota, eu concordo inteiramente, portanto, a educação de facto tem um papel primordial nos dias de hoje na formação dos jovens na luta contra a discriminação racial. Eu dou um pequeno exemplo, temos uma escola aqui em Lisboa, que é a escola secundária essa de Queiroz, nos Olivais, onde existem cerca de entre 15 a 20 nacionalidades diferentes, e é uma escola que demonstra exatamente um verdadeiro sucesso de integração de diversos tipos de comunidades, desde a comunidade hindu, a comunidade chinesa, descendentes luso-africanos, enfim, um conjunto enorme de várias nacionalidades e de pessoas, e que de facto é uma escola onde o exemplo de integração devia e é levado à conta. E ainda neste âmbito também acho muito importante falar, da Bolsa de Formadores que o Alto Comissariado para a Imigração e Diálogo Intercultural tem. No fundo é um conjunto de formadores que deslocam, cada vez que são solicitados, a cada uma das escolas, completamente grátis para os seus intervenientes, onde no fundo esses formadores incentivam a integração através da demonstração de filmes, de jogos entre crianças e fomentando exatamente aquilo que o Dr. José Mendes Bota disse, exatamente uma melhor integração no combate contra esta ideologia racistas e discriminatórias. Depois, eu acho efetivamente que a utilização dos mídias devia ser repensada atualmente na luta contra a discriminação racial, porque o papel dos mídias é de facto essencial. Eu digo isto porque penso que até nos exemplos que eu tive a poder observar nos países, principalmente nos países nórdicos, a forma como os mídias apresentam estas questões das discriminações raciais são muitas vezes preponderantes para romper com o preconceito que existe. E, portanto, isto começo, quando falo em mim, falo desde a utilização de diversos apresentadores de televisão, por exemplo, de diversas etnias ou nacionalidades, na própria apresentação dos programas de televisão que tenham, como, aliás, programas específicos na televisão, nos jornais, ou nas revistas, nos rádios, etc., que possam ter ou diretamente direcionados exatamente para a população migrante ou a população que possa ser considerada vítima de discriminação racial e mesmo para todos os outros pessoas que, de forma, mais uma vez, possamos incentivar a luta contra esta discriminação racial. Eu podia também começar com diversos exemplos. Aliás, eu penso que a maioria dos presentes aqui sabem que no ano passado Portugal foi colocado pelas Nações Unidas como no último relatório sobre o humano e desenvolvimento como o país que está em primeiro lugar em todo o mundo na atribuição de serviços aos estrangeiros, e portanto acho que de facto é de relevar esse reconhecimento por parte das Nações Unidas. Ainda assim, eu considero de facto que ainda há um longo caminho a percorrer, e portanto estes são apenas alguns exemplos. Não vos quero estar a extenuar com o conjunto de experiências, mas poderão ser mais vastas, mas estas são aquelas que eu considero que se enquadram mais neste preciso momento sobre o nosso debate. Muito obrigado.
Thank you for this example from Portugal, and let me offer the final one from my side. If we discuss about racism, xenophobia, it's really not necessary to be very serious with tragic faces and epoch-making ideas. I am a little bit skeptical as regards some official campaigns against these phenomena, but if humor and irony is used in such campaign, it could be helpful. One Czech NGO, Czech TV Foundation People in Need, prepared some time ago such irony humoristic campaign against racism and xenophobia. And skinheads, not natural skinheads, yes. And new fascists are described in this campaign as simple and silly individuals. And the main message was to be xenophobic is out of fashion. I tested this campaign on my two very critical sons, 18 and 22, and it's really functioning, it works, in this crucial age target group. In case of interest, I can offer you some details. So, we are very close to the end of this session. Let me ask Nils and Githu for their final, very short, brief remarks.
Very briefly, a number of issues were raised, which I would like to touch upon, about education. Education in and of itself is not a solution. If it's not, it depends on the content of the education, the methods of education, because there are survey data that shows that there is, in Western Europe, for example, there is a correlation between level of education and level of tolerance. There's no such correlation in the East. And if you look, and that raises questions about what people were taught in the communist years and so on in the East. This is survey data from the European Union a couple of years ago. So, and also education comes from parents. You can teach one thing at the schools, but the parents' media could teach you something else. And I think one issue that we're not addressing sufficiently is new media, social networking sites and these kinds of things. My children spend all of their time on there. And I was recently at a conference on the internet and racism, and they tried to get Google and Facebook in, but they didn't come. They didn't want to engage in this discussion. So I think we have to keep trying to get them involved in this discussion. Interesting question you raised about minority education, which is a hot controversial issue in many countries in Europe. ECRI generally comes out against where do you see minority education as a form of segregating minorities into lower quality schools. You see it with the Roma in particular in Europe, but not only with the Roma, you see it with certain immigrant groups and so on. There is a certain tension though between minority rights and integration, because a lot of minorities want their own institutions with their own language and culture and so on. And I think that's fine as long as the quality of education is the same as in other schools, as long as they acquire the language of the country so that they can compete in higher education in the job market, and if they have regular contact with children of the majority. If they are segregated, isolated, this is where stereotypes and prejudices can emerge. So I'm not against, I'm for minority education, but with a number of qualifiers. Regarding intercultural contacts in general, one area, one thing that was not mentioned, the Council of Europe put out a very good white paper on intercultural dialogue that was a product of a lot of consultations. And there were some very interesting areas on competence, intercultural competences in language and history and democratic citizenship, and I think that those should have been brought into the debate. Regarding nationality, I think facilitating nationality is very important, but so is granting voting rights to immigrants and non-nationals at the local level. Because again, this forces the politicians, and this is not only a school of democracy for these people in participating in public life, but it also forces the political parties, the politicians, and citizens to look at who their neighbors are and what their interests are. So this is why we advocate that as well. Regarding sexual orientation, it's outside of ECRI's mandate. We're not really allowed to look at it. But this debate is evolving, and in some bodies such as the OSCE, they look at hate crimes in a broader way, and any crimes motivated by hate towards a person because of their identity. And I think in the Council of Europe we're going to see this debate move forward. Until now, though, we do not really look at it. Trafficking only in passing often, regarding the climate of opinion towards these people, the specific discrimination against specific vulnerable groups. Finally, are we winning this battle, or is there any hope?
because we keep on adopting laws and institutions and programs and equality bodies. I put my hope in something called the Allport contact hypothesis. Gordon Allport was the father of kind of the social psychology of racism in American social sciences in the 50s. He came out with a hypothesis that intercultural contact, if it occurs in certain circumstances, leads to value change. And this can be scientifically tested. And there have been hundreds of studies done on this, and they show that, yes, it does lead to value change. People become more tolerant. They overcome stereotypes, prejudices, negative emotions towards other people. But a certain number of conditions need to be carried out. It needs to be of equal status. They need to have authority sanctioned for the contact. And it works. So if you work together, you learn together, you serve in the army together with people of different backgrounds, people's attitudes change. And this kind of mixing is very essential. And this is why discrimination is so bad, because discrimination keeps people apart. So in the long term, I'm hopeful, but we have a lot of work to do.
Thank you, Nils. And Gitu, please.
Very briefly, I'm glad to hear that my views on education have found support. I think that this is critical for this war. If you look at what is happening in sports, in music, in the movies, and so on, it is quite clear that young people can and are influenced by persons that they consider to be positive role models. And I think it's useful to concentrate on this. In some countries that I have visited, I have seen a lot of work going in this direction. And I hope that we can do more of that. Do we have a country that stands out as a beacon of hope in this? I'm afraid I'm not able to say that of a single country. But I've been to many countries where many different things are being done. In Germany, where I was very critical of the policy in general, in specific terms, I saw very progressive and influential programs of integrating Turkish children in innovative ways. And I think that that's an excellent idea. I think that in the UK and other places in Europe, there are many non-discrimination agencies that are doing innovative things about this problem. And therefore, it may not be fair to identify a single country. Of course, the United States, with its 100 years of wrestling with this problem, has many examples of failure and success, and we may want to do that. On the acquisition of nationality, I believe myself that this is the ultimate test stone, in that in Singapore, for example, where I spent some time, it is quite clear that the acquisition of nationality is not guaranteed to any migrant. It is guaranteed to migrants of a certain socio-political qualification, and so on and so forth. And that does generate a very, very deep side problem that we can discuss next time when we have time to do so. Yes, race and migration have a connection. In many parts of the world that I have been to, I have seen, for example, that Filipinos will be trafficked because they feel a certain need in the labor market, etc. Africans will be trafficked into the Middle East and Bangladeshis, Vietnamese, and so on, because they feed certain stereotypes of the, including stereotypes relating to sex and sexuality. Sexual orientation, I believe, as rapporteur on racism and xenophobia, this is a matter that is of very serious concern to me. That may come a little bit of a, I was surprised seeing that Africa has had in the last 6 months three high-profile misguided prosecutions. I'm happy to say that one in Uganda was dropped, one in Malawi has proceeded, but there has been clemency, and there is one ongoing one. And we keep monitoring this because we believe that if you fuel xenophobia on this issue, you make it possible for people to be xenophobic on other issues, etc., etc. And my colleague has talked about the internet, new media, and this is the new frontier in which we need to wage the war against xenophobia. Thank you.
Thank you, Gitu. And final space will be for Katerina from Ukraine as our rapporteur, but your glory moment will be after lunch to describe in more details. But not to understand your presentation instead of soup, we have only 2 minutes for your very brief summing up.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter. And first of all, thank you very much to our speakers and all participants for interesting and full ideas and information and recommendations presentations. And honestly, I am not repeating some important things at the moment, and just mention them, and I give myself opportunity to give more broad presentations of the results and reports from our session during the final session of our conference. And only like main framework of my report and recommendations. Any doubts, tolerance and pluralism are basis principle of a democratic society. And of course states have an important role to play in ensuring that people are able to live without a fear of racism and xenophobia. And both speakers stressed the important role of states in combating intolerance, racism and xenophobia, but both of them and as well as participants speak about the very active role of civil society. And we also can listed the main challenges in this area European countries, European societies is facing at the moment. And of course one of the main part of report after our session, it's solution and possible way of solutions. And I would like just to mention the main, which are using international legal instrument like UN Convention on Elimination of Racial Discrimination, Convention on Participation of Foreigners in Public Life, Protocol Number 12, which added the European Convention on Human Rights. It's of course national legislation which play a very important role, and level of implementation of legal framework and legal provision, and we spoke a lot about trainings and education both for professionals and children and youth, content of this education, data collection, policy audit to address a racial ethnic profile, etc. And if speak about the main recommendations from our session, I only would like to stress the first one, which was formulated by Peter. It is a recommendation for Council of Europe to continue activity in area of combating discrimination, racism and xenophobia. And more recommendations already were formulated by our speakers and participants, and I am going to present them during the final session. Thank you.
Thank you, Katerina. Thank you, Githu. Thank you, Niels. Thank all of you, and bon appétit.